Greetings, Sleepy Salsa here on this Saturday, March 31st of 2012, and welcome to the 47th episode of the Last Best Deal podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at youhavetreadonme.com. I will also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alisai's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro will be Bosa's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons attribution, specifically CC BY NCSA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille. Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E. TheLastBastille.wordpress.com. The blog is also now available in Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure Socket Layer, which is known vernacularly as HTTPS. We will be taking calls all throughout this broadcast. The chat room will be simultaneously be available as well. It is located primarily over at http://yhtom.chatango.com, as well as over at youhavetreadonme.com/radio. Also, it is imperative that any questions be constructive and on topic as much as possible. Believe me, although it is hard to not get off on tangents, staying on tonight's subject will be much appreciated, especially for the sake of the listening audience. If you have questions, please limit it to something we have covered or are currently discussing. As an additional courtesy, please mute your mic when we bring you in until we announce you by name. This episode, we are going to focus on the alternative media. Somewhere in so-called Western nation-states, there exists a free press. They can be hard to spot primarily due to the oligopolized corporate whore, lapdog mainstream media. However, there is the secondary reason that what passes for most of the alleged alternative media is nothing more than the internet version of the establishment's mouthpiece, albeit with a somewhat more palatable flavor. There comes a time in a man's life when he needs to stand up for what he believes to be right instead of what's easy. While the self-aggrandizement from so-called peers is difficult to totally avoid, the goal is to maintain one's integrity without succumbing to the same mentality of tyrannical control that the establishment itself is infamous for. Our guest tonight is Randy Mack. He is a podcaster, researcher, and militia member. Some of what we will be discussing will include the Under One Banner Petition, Committees of Safety, and the Architects of the New World Order. With that said, let us turn to our guest. Randy, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you, Sleepy?
I am doing quite fine on this lovely evening. So let's go ahead and get started. Randy, when were you awakened?
When I watched The Matrix. No, I'm joking. You know, I don't remember a time that I really didn't question everything. I started reading at a really early age. I read The Dead Zone, I think, when I was 6 or 7 years old. I read it in 4 days. By the age of 10, you know, that kind of stuff bored me, and I was reading Greek mythology. And then I jumped up to Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and people like that. Didn't really quite understand everything they were saying, but I got a minimal gist of it. About 14 years old is really the one I really saw through the fog of the entire illusion that we have out there. I read a book called The First Global Revolution. Had no idea what it was about. Saw it in the university library at UNLV. I used to go there and read a lot when I was young. I started going to UNLV when I was 14 and a half, maybe 15. I was actually going to school there while I was going to high school, and saw a book there called The First Global Revolution, written by King and published by the Club of Rome. And when I read through that, I realized, you know, there was a game afoot. And the book basically talked about the Club of Rome and the UN's plan to dissolve the sovereignty of every nation in the world and get them all under one collective government, and to bring in a fascist-type government at the top, you know, for those at the top, with a communistic type of government for the its at the bottom, as Plato liked to call us, the its. And from there, I just, names were brought out, you know, previous things were mentioned in the book, and I started researching that, started grabbing up more books. I started reading Bertrand Russell, The Impact of Science on Society. I read Bernays' book, Propaganda. I read Charles Dalton Darwin's The Next Million Years. I read Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment, as well as Brzezinski's Between Two Ages, before I was 16. And I kind of hit the road running at about 17. I joined my first militia at 17 in Nevada. And I started doing speaking engagements in Nevada, Arizona, Texas, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, around the age of 18.
All right. Well, what have your experiences been in the Patriot or overall Liberty movement?
What was that now?
What have been your experiences thus far in the Patriot or overall Liberty movement?
You know, I had a great time back in the 80s and 90s. I actually started back in the late 80s, around 88, really getting out there. I mean, I joined my first militia in 87, but I really started getting involved in 88. Really going out and talking to other people and engaging with others. I started doing speaking engagements when I was in 88. And then all throughout the 90s, I had a great time. I got to meet people face to face. I was talking to people constantly. Seemed like everywhere I went, I held a speaking engagement. A new militia was rising up. New militia was forming, forming for the right reasons. Got to meet a lot of wonderful people out there, salt of the earth type of people. Then around 98, 99, everything kind of died. All the militias broke up, actually maybe even a little bit before then. And for about 6 years, I just kind of sat around wondering, what the hell now? Where is everybody? I see all these things happening. I see the Military Commission Act coming out. I see the Patriot Act. I see all this stuff, and nobody's saying anything. Nobody's saying a damn thing about it. I'm wondering, where is the, where are the people? But times were good then, people were making money. Wall Street was booming and nobody cared. And then things started getting bad, people started getting upset again. The economy wasn't doing as well. People got upset. But by this time I was living in Canada. And it was kind of hard for me to do anything here in the States. I myself was a victim of that real estate crash. I had two mortgage companies and a real estate company. I lost everything I owned. Basically had a choice between living under a cardboard box or going up to Canada to stay with, the woman I was with at the time. Her father said he would help us out. I didn't have anybody here in the States to help me out at all. And I really didn't feel like living under a bridge in a box. So we went up there, and then I started seeing people getting angry again, getting upset, asking questions. I heard the grumblings again, the grumblings of the discontent. And I got online for the first time, and that was a whole different story than being face-to-face with people, but it was the only outlet I had. I mean, I was in Canada. I don't have any business telling Canadians what to do with their country or how to run their country or what kind of government they should have. That's up to them to decide that. And if they're willing to live in a completely socialistic state where everybody expects a handout, then so be it. It's up to them. So I got online. I jumped on the internet really for the first time in life. I had never really been online before, except in my, you know, I had a couple, I had a website for my company, but that was monitored and administrated by somebody else. I think I got on it maybe twice. I never got online before, really. And that was a whole new ball game there. You know, I met some great people, but along the way, you know, I also found that the vast majority of people that spend their time online talk a lot and do very little. Something I'd never really experienced before was the politics and the, well, as you like to call it, internal balkanization. And, you know, that was just a whole new game and everything. And it really, you know, I'll be honest with you, man. I've been online for 5 years now, and I'm pretty disgusted with it. You know, you can't get five people to sit down together and talk online with each other without it turning into a big fight and a big clusterfuck. Excuse the language. But that's what it is, you know. I mean, it's really sad. You know, I go out and meet people on the streets again, and it's a completely different story. I don't have these problems when I deal with people face to face. But then again, most of the people that I'm dealing with face to face, they don't spend a whole bunch of time online. You know, so maybe it's just a certain type of individuals that are attracted. I don't know. But I've met some good people online, you know, but unfortunately, you know, there's even more though that, I don't know. Maybe they need a lithium Prozac Zoloft cocktail every other day or something. I don't know. But it's been it's got its ups and downs. I mean, the internet's it's a good way to get some people together. But then again, you know, as I've always said, you know, you got to get offline. Turn that damn computer off. It's not a lifestyle. You got to turn the computer off. You got to get off the computer, and you actually got to deal with people face to face. And the more time you spend offline, the better off you're going to be.
Well, yes, of course. Although other people's experiences would suggest other results, but yours is absolutely valid with certain lines of evidence that is known. Speaking about that particular phenomenon, that leads very nicely into my next question, which is, what have your observations on internal balkanization been thus far?
We're getting to the meat and bones of it, aren't we, right off the bat? You're putting me on the spot here. Man, you know what? Again, like I said, you know, well, let's put it this way. You know, when I did my broadcast, it's kind of interesting. I'm actually doing an interview on my own, you know, on my own stream here. You know, initially this broadcast was supposed to be on a different quote-unquote station, if you will, but Sleepy decided to come over here. But we decided to keep the interview going anyways, but, and that's, you know, a whole nother story there, but, you know, it's for every 10 people I would talk to about coming, you know, that I would think I might want to bring on this broadcast, one made it. And there was a reason for that. You know, maybe I'm just overly selective. Maybe I'm too picky about the individuals we bring on. But, you know, I found that, you know, a lot of people out there, they don't get it. They'd rather, you know, ego tripping, cult of personality, if you will, whatever it is. Everybody wants to be a brigadier general, and nobody just wants to put in some damn work. And you know, like I said, you know, there's a lot of good people out there, but even the people that, you know, even the good people out there, the ones that aren't involved in all this stuff, you know, they spend their time blogging about the same old stuff every day, and nothing changes. You know, the internal balkanization, you know, I was listening to a broadcast back in the very, 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 very late 90s, maybe the early 2000s, and this lady came on. She was in her 80s at the time. And she said that she had been involved in the Patriot movement for over 60 years. And she said nothing has changed. And she said the one reason that she has realized that nothing has changed is because we cannot get along. We cannot work towards a common goal. That Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Too many personalities. Everybody wants to be the chief, and nobody just wants to put in some work. And, you know, it was interesting listening to her, because she has 60 years experience in this. And she said that for 60 years, the biggest problem she's ever seen on why we cannot get our liberty in this country, why we cannot all come together towards that common goal, is because we have to fight with each other. We have to. It's it's like a virus. It's like a sickness. It's like a disease. You know, you get 10 people together and 6 of them are going to want to fight about everything and about every little thing under the sun. And then the other 4 get disgusted and they go off on their own. And that's where we sit today with this internal balkanization. Just look online. You know, I was talking with somebody the other day and I asked him, I said, my God, you know, is it just me or is there a new type of patriot out there? You know, the ones that are constantly on the verge of psychosis. And again, you know, it came down to, I'm basing my opinion upon those who live their life online. You know, because when I look back around the people that I actually meet face to face, they're not like that. Those who spend their time offline for the vast majority of their time, they're not like this. But the problem is that new people come in and they see this and they see all the name slinging, the slandering, the defamation of character, just the constant infighting, and they go away and they don't come back.
Yeah, that sounds like a very effective mechanism for turning off the new guys. And that's an interesting thing, too. You mentioned several good things in there. You know, one of which being is that, like, look at it from the new guy's perspective. I mean, if this is something you're going to try and, you know, hitch up with to go fight tyranny or whatever the case is, next thing you know, like, even internally, you know, their own ranks are not good and they'd rather bicker with each other than go fight the enemy, then of course, you know, they're going to kind of go hide or otherwise not going to associate with that. And so that's interesting that, so in terms, and this is actually very leading into my next question very nicely. What do you think can be done to improve the Patriot or Liberty movement overall? And then more specifically, especially in terms of recruitment and retention?
For those that got their little personality trips that want to be the Patriot rock stars and the Patriot gurus, grow up. Grow up. You're not all that. You are no Washington. You are no Jefferson. Trust me. You know, for those that are just coming in, learn what you can. Use the computer, use the internet like a tool. Learn what you can. Spend the majority of your time offline. For those that find themselves constantly involved with it, pick and choose your friends wisely. You know, that's something, that's a motto I've always lived by. You pick your friends wisely. You know, and look for resources and outlets. You know, look for organizations and groups. You know, everybody needs to be on 500 websites. And, you know, my player's on 30 websites. You know, this player for UF Tredemy's on 30 websites, if not more. Hell, I don't even remember how many. You know, but anymore, though, I'm really limiting the number of sites that I myself personally visit. Because everywhere I go, man, it's just constant bickering and infighting and, you know, people still, you know, arguing over Woodland or ACU Digital. My God. You know, people are still fighting over Democrats and Republicans, and they never even realize that they're both screwing you royally. They never realize that both of them are just two wings of the same bird, and that bird is ready getting, you know, and that bird's only agenda is to gut you and eat you. You know, and then, you know, maybe if you're lucky enough, you'll come upon a good group of people who you can brainstorm with, get some clear, concise ideas of what's going on, what you need to do. And, you know, maybe you'll start acting then, engaging upon plans and strategies to secure yourself and your community and your family or whatever it is. And, you know. And then maybe if you're lucky enough or if you're unlucky enough to have here, you know, to actually get involved with some of these jackals out there, you know, these dividers. Although maybe you'll be lucky enough to hear about the common law court, the committee said the common law court, you know, and then you can actually just say, you know what, screw you, buddy. I'm going to file a complaint against you. And then you can have a jury decide on whether who's right or wrong. And then you can take that out there and just tell the world, hey, this guy's lying. Or this is what this guy's doing, and the jury, you know, a jury of his peers found him guilty of all these crimes. So, Now, maybe we actually start doing that. Maybe they'll just slink away and go back under the rocks in which they came out of.
Right. Now, there are a few things I want to follow up with that. And just for the sake of the listeners, especially the ones that found my broadcast over at, over on Blog Talk Radio, here's basically what's happened over the past 2 weeks. And I'm not really at liberty to get into details, but here's the short version. The last episode, podcast number 46, Internal Balkanization, was actually blatantly suppressed. And very soon after was my unceremonious expulsion from New Colony Media as of March 22nd of 2012. That is all I'm going to say publicly about that particular situation. But I will say that I did have previously standing offers from other folks to engage in other opportunities. But unfortunately, that is what happened. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of a good thing to kind of go on to things that that are better and wholesome. And that sort of thing. And so I find it interesting that, your previous comments about making sure you pick and choose who your friends are. I very much had to learn that, I guess you could say, trial by fire.
You know, hey, I came on, I tried to talk to everybody, you know. I've got to say, I don't have to like you to work with you. But even that philosophy of mine has been tested over the years, I tell you. Again, I don't have to like anybody to work with them. As long as we can be on the same book, hell, I don't even care if we're on the same page. As long as we're on the same general book, I can work with you. But, you know, hell, it's hard to find people that are even on the same book, in this quote-unquote patriot movement. You know how much I hate that vernacular anyways. Awaken, patriot movement, the cause. You know, I just want my freedom, man. I don't need all these catchphrases and slogans and, you know, hot word, buzzwords and stuff, man. That's all just propaganda again. Stalin said, man, we will conquer a people through slogans and propaganda, or through slogans and buzzwords. There you go, man. Everybody's got to have their buzzwords and their slogans, man. Why can't we just, be aware Americans who are concerned for our freedom? But we got to be a movement.
Right, and actually that can be addressed more deeply at another time, because unfortunately there is the issue of verbicide and semantics issues and stuff like that, absolutely, and that can get off into very fun arenas, suffice it to say. But yes, just for the sake of the listeners, that's kind of what's been going on with the podcast, but things are fairly stable now, so just to let you folks know. Moving on. So tonight's subject matter, or at least one of them, was about the alternative media. So Randy, why don't you go ahead and tell us the good, the bad, and the ugly of the alternative media?
All right, let's just get it up in front. Let's just start this thing off with let's just get it come out of the gate, man, with our head down and our horns out, man. Most alternative media is just crap. I'll be honest, it's just crap.
Why do you say that? Because I thought the alternative media, they were the good guys standing up to the corporate mainstream media who are bad and working for the establishment. So why would you say that most of the alternative media is bad? Why do you say that?
I'm listening to what's this guy's name, man? Freeman or something like that. Somebody dropped a link or something like that somewhere. I was like, okay, well, let's go check out this guy. I used to roam around listening to a lot of this stuff. This is why I got online and started doing my own broadcast. I'm listening to this one guy who says Obama's a clone of Akhenaten and his wife, Michelle Obama, is a clone of Anaximund. And, they've been, the U.S. and the world, the globalists have been engaging in genetic cloning, for decades now, and Obama is their new king. He's got proof of this genetic clone of Akhenaten, and his wife is Anaximund. I think he watched the Mummy one too many times. I hear this other stuff. Every time I turn around, everybody's got deep inside sources from the Pentagon or the White House, and it's guaranteed gonna happen 100%. Bet your bank on it. There's going to be martial law come anywhere, in April, May, June. You pick those 3 months, or it's always going to come at the time of the elections. And it's always coming from deep insider sources. Martial law in June. Nukes going to be used here, this and that. Martial law clampdown. Then you get to the other side, man, and it's no better than listening to Art Bell. You know, global consciousness. You know, we're all one. Well, you know, our founding fathers weren't one. They were individuals, and they believed in individual freedom. And I'm not one with everybody else. And, you know, isn't that just a whole same – isn't that just another boat there with – that globalism, we're all one, that new age, you know, the new age religion and philosophy that was created by the globalists back in the 1800s?
Well, wait,
1900s, we're all one?
Wait, hold on, let me stop you there for just a second. But I remember other, you know, big alternative media figures like, David Icke. He's like, consciousness. We're the capital C. We're consciousness. We are all one, right? Because one conscious, because that just makes sense because he said so. Because he says he's done 20 years of research. That must mean he's correct, right?
Hey, you know what? You can do 20 years of research, man, into alien reptoids all you want, man. It still doesn't mean you're right. You know, I mean, come on, seriously. You know, look at, I knew the guy back in the 90s, man. So, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s, you know. But, I mean, look at, William Cooper, man. I mean, he came out with alien, you know, with the whole alien conspiracy, and it was handed him from top government officials. Guess where that went? That was a big hoax there. You know, but I mean, that's what it is, you know, and every time I turn around, everybody out there is preaching doom and gloom, problems. The same damn story over and over again on 500 different Patriot radio channels, and nobody has it. Nobody talks about solutions. They keep bitching about the same old things, but nobody's actually talking about how to solve it, what to do about it. It's always another protest, another rally, another demonstration, another national organization popping up, and we're going to come save everybody.
Somehow being the operative
somehow.
Word. Somehow, right. And this is funny you should mention it, because I have mentioned on other podcasts and internet live streams and other such things like that about, well, technically the alternative media, what they're very good at, and however you want to interpret good, that's up to you. But what they're very adept at is what I like to call news and analysis. They'll report on what they think the enemy's doing, and then the analysis part is where they basically whine and bitch. But they almost never focus on problem solving. So that's kind of like the other side. And if you want to think of it this way, you could arguably say that the alternative media spends about – and I'm just going to throw this out, and the numbers aren't important, but it's – the relativity of what's being emphasized is about 90% news and analysis versus 10% problem solving. Now, me personally, I'm going to say for the first time publicly here, I personally think what we need to be doing is the exact opposite. 90% problem solving, 10% news and analysis. However, if for some reason people think that that's not good, hey, let's just do 50-50. 50% news and spend half of your time, you know, that accumulative amount of your time that you would spend on the news analysis, whining and bitching, going to InfoWars and Prison Planet everywhere else, great, do that half the time, but take the other half of that time and do some problem solving, because that would mean you have approximately 40% more time spent on problem solving, which means things can actually move forward, albeit slower than if you did 90-10. But you see, even splitting it 50-50 would be a starting point. No. But, you know, you say that, and I've said this several times before to other people, and it's just like, no, can't do that. We got to focus on, just the other day. And, you know, I like the guys over at Freedomizer Radio, but I have to admit, sometimes on some of their stuff, you know, occasionally I listen in and they'll mention something about, you know, and today we're going to have a discussion about this guy who had a heart attack while eating, you know, some sort of, you know, greasy burger and, you know, he wants to sue the company. It's like, what does that have anything to do with securing our liberties? And that's like that's a Patriot radio state. You see what I'm saying? So sometimes a lot of things will be irrelevant.
Well, let's look at it. I mean, let's look at Alex Jones, you know, and, you know, hey, you know, I'm just going to call it like I see it. This is the industry I came from. Before, you know, I was in real estate and mortgages, I was one of the top ad execs in the entire country. I worked for companies like, you know, I was the head guy for Hitachi, Nakamichi, Osix, Dainippon, major huge Japanese corporations trying to make their mark on America. And I see Alex Jones, you know, and here's the thing, you know, anytime you have a commercialized broadcast like Alex Jones, you know, sells everything under the sun, in order to keep people coming back and listening to you, you can't just keep talking about the same old things because it gets boring. You have to, once you sensationalize something, you have to keep hyping it up. And once they get used to that level of hype, you got to hype, you got to take it to the next level in order to keep them on their toes, or they're going to get bored and go somewhere else. You must constantly feed them instant gratification and horror. Otherwise, they're not going to keep coming back. And if they don't keep coming back, your revenue stream is going down the hill. So every time you turn around, I mean, if you watched Alex Jones back in the early 90s and you listen to him then versus now, you'll see this huge, this big progression, you know, this huge escalation of the amount of hype and sensationalism he puts in every story. It's gotten to the point now where, you know, I listened to Alex Jones for about 2 weeks. And everything he said, I would write down, verify this, and I would go and I verify it. And you know what? Didn't exist. Half the things he was talking about didn't exist. Or they were off tangent. Or he was putting his own rather generous spin on it. You know, there's nothing like interpreting, you know, your own interpretation of words. Verbicide, as somebody had mentioned earlier, you know. You know, we engage in verbicide, but not only that, but we also kind of elaborate upon the actual truth out there, because, you know, without that, you're not going to keep your people coming back once you keep getting them up used to a certain amount of hype and sensationalism. You got to keep them tuned in. You know, that's what Bernays did back in the early 20s. You know, we got out the radio when Bernays was the master of all this. He was the one who was brought into this country to change our culture. And the first thing that he started doing was going after women's libs and rights and things like that. The miniskirt started coming out. We had our first sexual revolution, not in the 60s, but in the 20s and 30s. Or, I'm sorry, in the 20s. And, you know, we got this little thing called radio that came out. And people stopped talking to each other on their way home from work and after they got home outside. They would have to rush home now because the new this week's show or this, you know, this week's continuation of the latest serial that was on was coming up soon, and they left us at a cliffhanger, very suspenseful moment, and we just got to catch it because we can't miss it. And then we stopped talking to our neighbors outside, and then we got TV, and then we stopped talking to each other inside, and then we got internet, and we even stopped sitting around each other inside, and we're all in separate rooms now. And that's how this game is played out, you know, but again, alternative media, man. I mean, look at all the hype and the drama and the sensationalism and just the flat-out bullshit that goes on in it. And I try to do something different here. Like I mentioned, you know, I used to listen. I tried listening to a lot of people, man, but I just felt my IQ dropping with every broadcast I listened to. And, you know, I finally, you know, said, well, you know, shit. You know, I've been wanting somebody to do a broadcast. You know, I've been waiting, you know, decade, you know, 2 decades almost for somebody to do a broadcast that I would want to listen to, talking about these things that are going on in the world without all this hype and the spin and the sensationalism and the consumerism and the marketing, man. Just give me some facts. Give me some actual facts that I can sink my teeth into and give me, and let's talk about some damn solutions. And hence came You Have Tread on Me. So, you know, I tried to do what nobody else out there was doing at the time.
Right, and you see, that's something, too, I've had a problem with certain major alternative media figures, and AJ included. And from my perspective, there are certain good aspects to him, but my major beef with Alex Jones is that he does not focus on problem solving. And when he attempts to do it, it's like, oh, you know, my major thing is essentially go protest and vote for Ron Paul. And you know what? If he's got more ideas, I'd love to hear it. But, you know, sometimes I've heard stuff like go talk to your neighbors or, you know, some kind of like vague generality like that. And then he'll go on a rant for another 20 minutes or something. It's like, okay, the rants are entertaining and to some degree motivating, but that I don't see how that helps me do anything to secure my liberties. I mean, I would have loved it if he had done a broadcast he's got like 4 hours a day or whatever. I would have loved it if he had done something like, yes, and today we're going to have a special broadcast and we're going to learn how to field strip like an AR-15. Now, what you need to do is, you see, that would have been good. Or let's take something else. And today we're going to learn how to do, you see, anything would have been good, anything to move things forward, anything that he's always said he's a big history buff. You know, why not? Let's talk about, like, the Constitutional Convention. And today we're going to have a history lesson about the Constitutional Convention. You see, anything like that would have been beneficial other than, and today, the global, here's the 20 millionth awful thing the establishment did this week. I'm so angry. I don't need to hear that. I get it. There are problems. We're trying to fix it. But we don't fix it by yelling about it every day or every week. There is a time and a place for news and analysis, but there also needs to be at least the equal opportunity, in a manner of speaking, for problem solving. And the alternative media as a whole is, at least most of it, is failing at it miserably. Now, yeah, there are some attempts to move this forward. You know, you are obviously, I am. There's some other people we both know that are trying to move things forward. But quite honestly, you know, I mean, how many times does somebody need to cover, you know, I'm just going to use this as an example.
Chemtrails.
I was going to say fluoridated water. But
fluoridated water.
Right, but the point is that, okay, well, once you've, like, covered that issue, let's say you make a podcast about it or whatever, great, whatever. But what about the overall situation, or what about some other different areas? How about, like, you know, for those guys that are more of the survivalist bent, how about post-collapse food production and growing food? Let's do, like, something, let's focus on that. I would love to hear a broadcast of the Alex Jones Show, or of Mike Rivero's What's Really Happening, or anybody else about, and today, children, we're going to learn about how to, grow some corn. Now, what you're going to need is, you see, you know, so for the post-collapse, you see, that would be something good. But no, nothing about problem solving, not even in a minor way, not even with your family. It's very distracting. You know, so we'll hear about, like, Kony 2012, and it's like, okay, look, anybody with a brain knows that that particular instance is a con artist trickery thing, okay? If the new guys need to be brought up to speed, there's plenty of us that exist that will be more than happy to bring them up to speed. But I don't see why somebody who's really well-known needs to go railing about it for 2 hours or something. That doesn't make any sense. You know, and here's the other thing. I mean, there's other aspects to certain things during the Revolutionary War period that I think were important. To use one example, how about committees of safety? I mean, guys, when was the last time Mike Rivero talked about committees of safety? Does anybody know? Yeah, exactly. It's just like, that's one thing, not even counting other stuff. That's kind of like a big deal. But no, we're supposed to protest and vote for Ron Paul because that's what they told us to. And that I kind of have a problem with because it's intellectually lazy. I don't care how good they are at news and analysis. Some of them are actually quite terrific, to be fair. But problem solving, that is the only – we need to focus on that in order to transition from our awful situation to something better. And I'm not seeing the steps being taken to expedite the process.
I am. You know, hey, you know, somebody had put up a thing in the chat room, you know, we need a Patriot on, and we need a whole – slew of Patriots on to do their own broadcast. Well, if you know anybody, let them know. I honestly, my vision now, I've been lazy. I'll be honest with you guys, I've been lazy. You know, I kept this broadcast with myself only. I let, you know, Fox came on for a little bit. He was on here for a while. And, you know, that was because I knew Fox and, you know, I knew that he was going to uphold the standards to which I was doing my broadcast with. You know, no BS, no Masons, no aliens, no, you know, none of these dividing factors are just fantasy realm stuff. You know, I'll leave that to the coast to coast and, you know, Truth Frequency and all these other people that want to get into aliens and all this other stuff, you know, mixed in with patriotism and U.S. history. But, you know, I want that. You know, I'm trying to find good hosts, bring on a whole slew of them. I'd like to get, you know, 7 days a week broadcasting on here, you know, numerous shows a day, you know, covering everything of interest and importance. You know, I've tried to do it myself with various series that I do. Tar and Feather, we discuss the American Revolutionary period and other things that correlate, you know, that correlate between that time period and our time period today, as well as the actions that our founding fathers took then, and maybe some things that we should be looking at today. Guerrillas in the Mist, I talk about asymmetrical warfare. Resistance to Tyranny, I bring on retired Colonel Joseph P. Martino, who was the insurgency expert for the U.S. military for 20 years. You know, Survival Sundays was a long-running episode. I did the Militia Mondays trying to bring out a different viewpoint of what militia were about, and I interviewed a whole slew of different militias on, but again, you know, for every 10 I talked to, I brought one on. It's kind of hard. You know, so I've tried to encompass all that, but man, I'm just one guy, so, you know, I mean, there was one point I was broadcasting 5-6 shows a week, putting in 60-70 hours into it, man, and I just, you know, got to be too much. So, you know, I realized, you know, I'd rather have 1% of 100 people than 100% of myself. So now I'm trying to find some decent people that can come on here and do their thing. You know, I want that history buff that can come on and talk about our the U.S. history, you know, Revolutionary, Civil War, whatever it is. You know, I want that guy who can come on and talk about news and analysis and then actually kick down some solutions. You know, I want that guy who can come in and, you know, or girl, whatever. I'm not being, you know, gender specific here or anything. You know, men, women, I don't care. You know, but it's what I'm trying to do here, and that's what I've tried to do with this broadcast myself.
Right, and I think what we're getting at is that there needs to be more of that, and, you know, that's why I think it's important to emphasize that I think what we're noticing as far as the bad and the ugly of the alternative media is that they spend too much of their time on news and analysis and distractions, or actually there was also a concept that another individual who at this time will go unnamed due to his request termed the carnival of distractions, where he basically described the internet as being kind of like a carnival of distractions with various things, which is kind of unfortunate. But again, I think what we're getting at here is that it's most of the alternative media that unfortunately has kind of devolved into kind of like an internet version of the establishment, which I think is kind of hard to say, but I think it's very accurate. Now, that's most. It kind of begs the question, what about everyone else? Well, here's the thing, and something I've noticed, and I would like your perspective on this, Randy, is that one way you can tell, in terms of vetting, I guess you could say, one way you can tell if someone is serious is what do they focus on? You know, if they're focusing on fluff or stuff irrelevant or whatever, you know, news and analysis and nothing but, then maybe you should go like, okay, maybe this is not where I want to spend my time, and somebody then yelling at me or whatever. But then if you have somebody who is really kind of going in depth and examining, like, how can we make this thing work, whatever the thing is? You know, let's make, you know, a homeschooling co-op thing work. Let's make this particular local alternative currency work. Let's set up a third-party arbitration type thing over here. Let's go set up a civil authority over there. Whatever the project is, if that is what someone's focusing on, maybe you should, as the listeners, maybe you guys should at least give them a greater level of credibility than you would with the guys who are just, you know,
doom and gloom.
Yeah, and whining and whining,
sensationalism.
Right, and whining and bitching about the latest police brutality thing or something. And that's the worst part. I mean, I say something like, anyone says something like that, and it almost sounds as if you're making light of it. I'm like, no, but the point is that you could spend an entire lifetime doing nothing but news and analysis and get absolutely nowhere. We've seen proof of this. The history proves it. You know, this isn't just me saying it. So in order to move things forward, got to do problem solving. And I would even venture in so far as to say is that I think more of a think tank mentality, I think, is what's needed. I mean, look
at that. I agree. Let's look at it. You know, you talk about think tanks. Well, you know, the UN has set up thousands of things. Think tanks are called NGOs, non-governmental organizations, the head of which is the Club of Rome. And these, every time there's a new NGO set up, they're given, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And they do nothing but work on one individual project, whatever that project might be. And they'll spend a lifetime working on it, trying to implement it and getting it into order. And while they're working on that one project, somebody else is working on another project. And what do you know? Lo and behold here, we have a completely different country than what our founders had ever envisioned for us. Maybe the enemy's plan is actually working. Maybe their ideas work, and maybe we should actually take a note or two from the way they operate, and maybe we might, you know, put that in reverse and, operate and, do something like that and maybe we'd actually get somewhere. But then again, you know, that would actually take people working together towards a common goal. And we already discussed that.
Amazing. Something as simple as that.
Look what happens. You know, I mean, all these globalists are working together for a common goal, and look how successful they are. And we can't even get together and talk about what that, you know, we can't even discuss the Constitution without everybody fighting over it.
Right, exactly.
4,000 little words, man. It's not that difficult. It was written for the most common man of the day. Unfortunately, you know, common sense was a lot more common than it is back, than it is now. And we, you know, you get 10 people together and they got 10 different interpretations of what the Constitution says and what each one of those Bill of Rights and what, you know, the original 1 through 10 means. The one, you know, the first through 10 amendments. You know, everybody's got their own little personal agendas, their own little ego trips, their own little cult of personality going on. And we can't work together. And like that lady said back, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, she's been around for 60 years. And the only reason she can think of that we have not actually restored our country back to its roots and restored our liberty and freedom is because we cannot work together.
Yeah, and I find it funny that the previous episode I did was suppressed over at BTR, and it's interesting. Just when you get to the heart of something, look at who's, you know, who's doing what in terms of you know, censorship. So it's true, and it's not just me too. I mean, you can look at other, you know, there's been a history too, guys. Just go look around the place where certain sectors of the alternative media will forcibly censor other aspects of the alternative media as well. I mean, this has happened, so this isn't just like my recent thing. This is also with other stuff, and this is a pretty big problem. You know, too, it's kind of a manifestation of various types of phenomenon which need to be addressed, or else, you know, nothing will move forward. And that's kind of where the current sit rep is, I guess you could say. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the other thing too. I mean, you mentioned about, you know, the bad guys essentially, you know, working together and that kind of thing. Well, here's the other thing, too. I mean, I find it funny that one of the many, 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 many grievances for why some types of political dissidents are against the establishment as they are is because they don't like the bad guys having secret meetings. I would like to use the Bilderberg Group as one example. Okay, so you don't like the bad guys having secret meetings, and you don't like the fact that using the Bilderberg Group as an example, you don't like the fact that the Bilderbergers get together and have secret meetings and plot, and their plans are effective, and they're working together and they have meetings. But oh no, when the good guys, or the guys who claim to be the good guys, try and have a meeting, oh, we can't have a meeting. Nothing ever happens at meetings. So it's like, but wait a minute, the bad guys have meetings. That's one of the things you're upset about. So why can't we, the good guys, have meetings? That like doesn't make any sense right there. I mean, we already know it works. They're doing quite well with it. Or let's look at another aspect. They have secret meetings to plan stuff and then carry out those plans. Well, can we have a plan? Oh no, we don't need a plan. We just need to, you know, wake people up in mass, and then everything will mystically somehow, you know, along with some unicorns and flying pigs, will somehow liberty will manifest itself out of thin air if we just wake people up in mass. Somehow, maybe, you know, it's like, but that's, I mean, that, but again, it's methodology. I'm not talking in terms of philosophy, obviously. I'm talking about methodology. The bad guys have secret meetings to plan stuff, and those things work. So why can't the good guys have just meetings of any kind to do things? And one of those functions would be to plan things in order to make good things happen. Oh, no, but we can't do that. It's like, well, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. That doesn't make any sense. You know, it's just like, whoa, I've literally had conversations like that, private conversations like that, Randy. And I just like, wow, these are the folks that claim to want to secure their liberties. These are the guys who claim to be against the establishment. And you know what? Even if they are genuine, because I'm not going to go around saying somebody's controlled opposition without proof, because that's just lazy. But I think folks, like, when they start doing that and more things that are very divisive, I think it would be fair to say that they're basically acting as useful idiots. And that's the last thing any of us need.
Well, you know, the useful idiots are useful, too.
I guess in one respect. But let's take a look, too, at, you know, so Now, why is there an alternative? So let's back up a little bit. Like, why is there an alternative media in the first place? I mean, isn't the mainstream media, you know, fantastic, or is there something more nefarious afoot?
Who's that guy from that used to be on Fox? He started up that 912 project, writes books.
Are you talking about Judge Andrew Napolitano?
No, not Napolitano. We could talk about him though too, but let's talk about the other guy that used to be on with him as well. Glenn Beck. Let's talk about Glenn Beck.
Oh no.
You know, Glenn Beck, you know, hey, he was out there, he was talking about the founding fathers, he was talking about common sense, he was talking about our founding as a country. Yeah, when you listen to him, you bring up the word militia, we're all bad guys. You bring up right to keep and bear arms, and he's kind of against that, but it's okay for him to own and keep and bear arms. You know, people having bulletproof vests is bad, but it's okay for him to have a bulletproof vest. Again, you get the hypocrisy in there. You know, the Bill of Rights and that Declaration of Independence and that Bill of Rights is not a pick and choose. It's not a Chinese food buffet where you take what you like and you leave the rest. It's an all or nothing concept. It's an all or nothing deal. And that's the way it is. You know, when we look at the media, you know, you got Fox News, which is unbiased, unpartisan, and well, you know, all they do is cheer, you know, they're the cheerleaders for the Republicans. Well, who brought us the Patriot Act? Ooh, not the Republicans. Who took us off the gold standard? Or the silver standard, because we already taken off the gold standard. Who took us off the silver standard? Ooh, not a Republican. That would have been Nixon. Who brought in this massive militarization of our police forces on a massive scale with the war on drugs? Oh, not the Republicans. Shall I go on?
Yeah, exactly. So I think what you're getting at is that there's also these kind of fake leaders or make-believe kind of a thing going on. And also a little bit, too, I've noticed where it's kind of a mentality. It's a video game mentality, like playing Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like a real, I guess you could say, real-life version of like a role-playing game or something. The Cyber Patriot phenomenon, I think, is what it's referred to as well, that's kind of interconnected with all that.
Well, you know, again, you know, we got people, you know, there's too many people out there that think the internet is a lifestyle. But let's look back. You know, I mentioned some of these books that I read. You know, there was a book that was written called Tragedy and Hope by Brzezinski. I think it was written in 72, somewhere between 72 and 76. I think maybe 74. I think it was written in 74. Anyways, there's a whole section there called Technocracy. And in that particular chapter, he spoke about a new communication system that was going to be unleashed upon the public of the world, and it would connect everybody around the world. But he said it will also be the greatest dividing force amongst the people, including and up to the home, up to dividing the home. He said people will end up spending their life on this thing. It will consume them. It will divide the family. And let's look around. You got people, man, they live on that internet, and it's their life. I mean, if the net went down today, do you know how many people would be jumping off of bridges tomorrow? I mean, you already have kids out there, man, killing them, you know, committing suicide because their character in World of Warcraft died. My God, really? Really?
Yeah, I think
I played video games when I was a kid, you know, man. But those were for rainy days, man, when we were stuck inside. We couldn't wait to get outdoors. We could not wait to get outside the house. We would burn through our chores and get them done so we could get outside and talk to our friends and hang out with our friends and do things with our friends.
Yeah, I think what you kind of indicated was a little bit of too much of a fan devotion, in a manner of speaking. But, yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the other thing, too, with especially the mainstream media, particularly, is I think there's this phenomenon called predictive programming. So, predictive programming. And have you noticed it in the alternative media as well?
Predictive programming is a concept that came about by, well, Freud, really. But actually, Plato. Said that these techniques that we use to enslave people, those techniques that he wrote about in his book, The Republic, he said these techniques that I describe here and now are not of my creation. These are not new things. And he used those word, that word, technique. These are not new things. These have been mastered ages before now. In ancient Greek, you were required to go to plays. You, your household, your slaves were required to go to these plays. And these roaming troops of playwrights and actors were sanctioned by the government to produce certain types of plays with certain themes. And you had to go and you had to watch these so you could be downloaded with the most politically correct stance on anything of the day, what was accepted. And the people learned from this and they were taught how to react to any situation based upon how the actors reacted to that situation in those plays. Now, in the modern times, the Fabian Society created this little group called the Futurist Society. And they brought together a whole bunch of writers like H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw. It's still going today. I mean, George Lucas is a member of the Futurist Society. He's on the open roster there. Anybody can go look this stuff up. All you got to do is get online and actually don't read blogs and stuff. Go read the UN's website. Go read the Fabian Society's website. Go read, you know, all these other people's websites that are actually telling you what they're doing. But the Futurist Society, they started pulling together the greatest writers of that time, or those who would go along with it, to start writing stories now about the future, about things that these globalists knew that they were going to bring in the future, so that people would read about them now, become used to these ideas, so this way when they came into being in the future, it wasn't this culture shock to them, it wasn't a reality shock to them. They had already been reading about it for years. For instance, you take a look at, anything, man. Let's pick a movie. What was that movie with Schwarzenegger in it, where he was on Total Recall? You see Schwarzenegger plugging into a machine where he actually lives a reality, a life. Well, that's been in the works for a while. He then, during this reality scene, you see this scene where he's running through the airport. And he goes through a body scanner. What do you go through today in your airports?
You're not used to it, though. Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, we see these shows where, you know, if you look back in the 80s, the vast majority of the shows that were coming out were about doctors, lawyers, and police. And we were shown, for the first time ever, SWAT teams kicking in doors on TV to desensitize us to it and get used to it. So this way, when we saw it on the news, it wasn't this big shock to us, because before that, my God, we would have been up in arms over this. They programmed us to get used to these ideas. So when they implemented these things, we would react a certain way, which was just like the people in the shows did. Get on the ground, get down, get down, get down. And what do the people do? They get down. And nobody questions anything. Nobody asks any questions. Nobody stands their ground and says, no, you will show me that search warrant. But then again, it's kind of hard to show a search warrant when you got flashbangs going off in your face and 10 guys coming in at you and, you know, little laser and, you know, with little laser sights, little, you know, red dots floating all over your body. And four, you know, two or three guys grabbing you, tossing you down, and hog-tying you. It's kind of hard to say no at that point. You know, but we were told that this was necessary, and we were shown these things. And it's at that point that we started raising up these attorneys, these doctors, and these police up on a pedestal. And now if you look around, and firemen as well, you know, the service industries, if you will, you know, those social services, you know, Plato, or who was it, Stalin had said, the service industries of today will become the authoritarian branches of tomorrow. There are police services, there are fire services, the medical services. Now, you go in, you know, and you got doctors snatching up kids and forcing injections upon them. You have doctors that force you to take things, and if you don't, they commit you. You got, you know, and we had a whole generation raised up on watching these shows, you know, of these cops kicking in doors, and they thought that's the way it was. So then they grow up, they want to be just like that. And what do you know, man? They become cops and they kick in doors just like that. Never understanding that, first off, before I could get that search warrant, I had to have, you know, I had to get a search warrant from, it had to, you know, my proof had to go before a grand jury. And they had to say there was probable cause. And then I could get the search warrant and I could go to this person's house, knock on their door, and they had to open the door and say, can I help you? And he would say, I have a warrant to search your home. And they had to, you had to give it to them so they could look at it and verify that A, that is the person that is on there is you. B, this is the address that they're going to search. C, that you understood what exactly it was they were looking for, not just this carte blanche. I'm going to ransack your house, destroy everything, and leave your place looking like a tornado went through it. And we got used to that being the norm. We no longer ask to see that search warrant because we don't think we can. We don't realize that we have actually have a chance to look it over and verify it for its validity. Yes, I am this person. Yes, this is the correct address. Okay, fine. You are here to search for this, this, and this in these areas and only that. Okay. You're going to stick to that, and I'm not going to let you look anywhere else because you don't have the right.
Right. So I think what you're
programming.
Right. So I think what you're getting at using that as an example is that you essentially have fiction being blended with reality in such a way so that should you, the individual in reality, comes across that situation, that simulation, because it wasn't real, that simulation, you would know ahead of time. Again, it's monkey see, monkey do. You should be acting the same way. Again, like the example you gave about when the black suited cops come in and see everyone get down, like you see on like 24, you know, hey everyone, hey all the guys on Fox News want to be Jack Bauer, right? You know, get down, and all this. We need to get them terrorists. Yeah, we need to get them terrorists because we want to be Jack Bauer. You know, and all this kind of stuff. Well, I mean, is anybody really surprised when your run-of-the-mill neoconservatives act the same way? I mean, that's another example of predictive programming, too. Now, Ohio Frontiersman in the chat room wants to ask, does porn have predictive programming?
Yes and no. Yes and no. You know, back in the 60s, there was a book written by Lord Bertrand Russell. Now, Lord Bertrand Russell, he had a mandate. He was actually mandated from the Queen of England. He was told to figure out children and how to use the children to destroy the family. So he created a special school, a charter school, a crown charter school, which means that this school had special permission from the Queen or from the Crown at the time to open up and act in whichever authority it needed to. So he took this school and he took a bunch of kids in it, very young kids. And he was basically working off of Plato's ideology that you must take the kids as, you know, damn near at birth and train them in all things state. This way, when they grow up, they will never have a thought outside of what they've been programmed to think. Now, what Bernays found out during the school, and he did some heinous things to these children. Group masturbation and group sex at as early as 5 or 6 years old. His main thing was sexual overstimulation of our youth, because what he found out is that when you hypersexualize a child, that later in life, and remember they follow these kids throughout their life, that you will have a very hard time forming any kind of lasting bonds, be it with family, friends, loved ones, you know, opposite sex relationships, things like that. That breaks up the family, because when you can no longer hold a lasting bond with another individual, you will no longer be close with your family. You will no longer form any lasting commitment with a person of the opposite sex and be married and have it last. You will basically just have this constant running string of sexual encounters. What better way to divide and conquer a people than to destroy the very basis of community, the family? And this is all for, you know, it's all right there. I mean, he wrote about it. It's in a book, Bertrand Russell, The Impact of Science on Society. You know, now he did things with these children that should have had him hung in England. But because he was given permission by the Queen, it was okay. And so now let's look at it. You know, there's not a kid under the age of 12 that has not watched porn online. Porn is everywhere. It's, you know, they broadcast, they promote it, they produce it. I mean, hell, you've got commercials now for Trojan vibrators on TV, or not, is it Trojan?
Right. And also, don't forget, even when they're advertising for non-sexual materials like condoms, like my favorites are the, what's it called, like the Axe deodorant.
Yeah.
Or even some like Gillette ads, for instance, will also be like, once you're smoothly shaved, because they don't actually say this, but you'll see the beautiful woman go up to the guy who just shaved with a Gillette product and touch him and, you know, in a very kind of seductive way. And so there's that too, but especially those Axe deodorant ads are like, whoa, I didn't know I was watching softcore here.
You know, we got commercials now for vibrators on TV. You know, with the women with their hair all blown back, stiff and stuff, and they're like, I got mine. You know, there was another point, though, that I brought up, you know, and I forgot to mention this. You know, it's also, you know, Gary pointed out in the chat room, what, you know, like that particular episode, you know, with the terrorism, you know, whatever we do is okay, torture, whatever it is, as long as we get the bad guy in the end. You know, it's also showing that they don't have to follow the rules. As long as that they're protecting the public, it's okay if they break the rules. It's okay if they go, if they exceed their authority, because they're saving lives and they're stopping crime and they're protecting the public.
Right. And in fact, if anything, you know, it wasn't just the example I used earlier of, you know, 24. I mean, you can even get other, like your run of the mill cop show too, like not just the original, but also the spin-off like Law and Order TV shows. Of various kinds. You know, there are certain ones where, oh, well, he's been accused of being an XYZ thing, so we're going to, you know, send the SWAT after him and, you know, throw him in a cage without any evidence or whatever the case is. Or, oh, this guy, he's a gun owner, that means he's dangerous. Or they'll just, like, make shit up. And they just do. It's like, wow, I mean, talk about being ignorant. I mean, really.
You know, we talk about the over-sexualization of our youth, you know, if you look at the Disney cartoons coming out over the last 20 years, you know, you'll see, you know, we stopped being able to do subconscious programming in, you know, in TV and in movies and stuff, you know, where things are flashing by so fast you can't even see them, really, where they're buried beneath the picture. Like in the 50s, they did this thing in a theater, eat popcorn, drink Coke. And every time those things flashed across the screen faster than the eye could see it, your eye saw it, your mind registered it. People were flooding. Every time these came out, they were flooding to the concession stands to buy Coke, to buy popcorn, to buy candy. But now they can't do that anymore. So what they do is they make it a little bit more visible. So, you know, if you look at like the Little Mermaid, you know, they've got genitalia embedded it within the actual drawings themselves. Bacardi did a, Bacardi had a billboard for a while with some melting ice that actually had a naked chick inside of the ice. You know, these are the things that they do. You know, they hypersexualize our youth and, well, us as well. And look at the relationships. I mean, you know, 52% of all marriages end in divorce now?
It's ridiculously bad, yeah. So... yeah, so obviously there are many methodologies that the establishment uses, but one of the more pernicious ones is predictive programming, because in a lot of ways you're being downloaded with thoughts, ideas, and slogans and other things like that that are not your own. So it would kind of behoove all of us to be very careful. And if I remember correctly, I think even Alan Watts suggested that if you're watching like a television show, a movie, etc., you should take notes about all the politically correct inserted words, slogans, and phrases, and then afterwards go and read your notes and just see. I mean, did they make like a passing climate about? A passing comment about how great climate change was, for example, but they slipped it in an episode that was about something completely different that had nothing to do with climate change, because that happens a lot too. They'll slip in stuff that like or whatever. I mean, there's lots of different ways they can do it. You know, a lot of things are in the dialogue. Other things are more imagery.
Look at beer commercials. Look at beer commercials. What do half-naked chicks in bikinis, you know, that are barely able to be called bikinis, have to do with beer?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I mean, it's just kind of awful. There is the old, you know, advertising notion about sex sells. So, I mean,
it does.
Right, right. You know, or, you know, taking it or appealing to a different audience. Obviously, you could take like a, you know, a muscular topless man and put him next to, or put him in, like, in a kitchen, and suddenly, you know, certain types of, you know, women and others would just go gaga. But then you insert your product, like, dude, it could be something as simple as, like, a fan, and say, this keeps you cool, and then you can make it look sexy. It's just like, oh, geez, really? What does that have to do with the topless guy in the kitchen? But, yeah, the point is that the enemy likes to use that for their own purposes, and then you get distracted, and then you start behaving in the way they want you to instead of how you want to behave. And it's all behavioral control, I think, is what we're really kind of getting at here. So, Randy, why don't you take the next several minutes and describe who the architects of the New World Order are?
All right. Well, you know, why don't we start? Why don't we do this? Because this is an old plan. I mean, Plato was writing about it back 2,300 years ago. But let's just take this one, this New World Order, if we will. This New World Order was actually conceived about, you know, back in the 1850s with three individuals who were given a mandate. Lord Cecil Rhodes, who owned De Beers and owned Liberia, or who owned Rhodesia in Africa, plus a whole bunch of other countries in Africa. He was told to gather Lord Rothschild and Lord Milner, two bankers, two of the two biggest bankers in all of Europe, both English, and to create the Anglo-American establishment. Now, this Anglo-American establishment was Britain taking over the world. They said the first thing they had to do was to destroy America, because a country like America could never stand. It had to become back under the fold of the British Empire. So Cecil Rhodes and them created something called the Round Table, the Round Table Society. And Cecil Rhodes described the Round Table Societies as rings within rings. And just when you got to what you thought would be the uppermost ring, you would realize that that was not the top ring, that there was more rings branching off in 10,000 different directions, and you would never know who the leader was. So they formulated this plan on how to take over the world. And their plan wasn't, you know, a plan that was going to take place over the next 5 to 10 years. Their plan, they estimated, would take 200 years to bring about the perfect society. They said between 150 and 200 years. So they started laying it out, started creating 1-year plans, 5-year plans. You know, they worked in, they basically reverse engineered this plan. Okay, this is how we want to end up, so how do we get there? And they knew that the first thing they had to do was to destroy a culture. In order to destroy the culture, you had to destroy the family. So how do we do that? So they started going after the children. They started bringing in propaganda to change our culture here in America with Bernays. Back in the 19-teens, you know, 1915 and 17, whatever it was. We brought about the first sexual revolution back in the 20s, which was meant to hypersexualize and destroy family. They knew that in America, that was the big thing. You had to destroy family first, and then you had to destroy our culture. And then the next thing they went after was our youth. Again, through education, we start dumbing them down. Now, this took on a heavy, now this took a major toll or a major push with the creation of the UN, when the UN brought in Julian Huxley, who was a student of Lord Bertrand Russell, of his writings and his works, as well as many other of the families out there. And he created the UNESCO, which was supposed to be create the standard for education across the world. And that standard was basically to take us away from a critical thought process education, algebra, Latin, things like that, to more of a you do as you're told and just memorize facts. Do not think, just memorize. So that's where it started at. Now, their first run at doing this, they knew that they had to create conflict. They had to create something so scary that all the worlds would come together and give up their sovereignty and form under a coalition, if you will. So World War I was created, and you can read all about this. I mean, they write about this openly in their own books, H.G. Wells and the Open Conspiracy. You know, George Orwell, everybody talks about George Orwell in his books, Animal Farm, 1984, you know, Great Patriot. He warned us about it. No, Orwell was part of that whole socialist movement. He was his job was to go to Spain and bring socialism and Nazi, you know, socialism, fascism, Nazism, whatever it was, to Spain, kill off the ruling family there, the nobility, and bring in socialism, fascism, communism. It's all the exact same. It's an oligarchy of control. Well, when he realized that it wasn't a workers' revolution and for the people, but really for a very few elite to control everything, he ran back to the States and started writing books. Now, these books already had contracts for them, so they were guaranteed to be published, but when they actually saw what he was writing, all of a sudden those contracts disappeared, and it took them a hell of a lot longer to get out, and they never really did get distributed very well. You know, so, you know, that's how it started off, with these three guys getting together, being ordered to by the Crown of England to form, to figure out a way to destroy the sovereignty of the of all the nations of the world and bring them all under one global rule. Now, we formed the League of Nations after World War I because it was so heinous that we could never allow anything to happen like this. But people here in America were smart. We knew better. And even though the U.S. government was involved in the creation of it, we the people stood up. And we said, hell no, we are not giving up any of our sovereignty. And it fell apart. The League of Nations is no more. They said, that's okay. Well, just obviously World War I wasn't heinous enough. So they sat back, they waited. They had their opportunity with World War II. Now, World War II was not started by Hitler. If you look back, World War II, the actual Nazi party was started by a British lord who was of the Germanic families, and his birthright was a republic in Germany, one of the republics of Germany. So he went down there, claimed his birthright, and created the Nazi party. He then brought in Hitler to be the chancellor of this party because Hitler was charismatic. But the very first Nazi uniform that was ever put on was put on by a British noble, this guy who started the Nazi party. I forgot his name offhand, but if you look it up, you'll find it. And his job now was to create something even more heinous than World War I. So now we have World War II, and that was heinous. And that shocked the world. And we said, never again can we let something like this happen. So they come up again with the UN. And everybody flocks to it, and Americans join it, because, my God, we can't ever let anything like this happen before. So we joined the UN. But yet, if you look back in 1933, you know, so the UN started implementing a lot of its things. Open immigration. Enforced open immigration. Now, if you read their open immigration policies, their policies were focused for one thing, to create immigration, a floodgate of immigration into the U.S. and other countries, from cultures so vastly diverse that it would destroy our culture within. So we weren't bringing in immigrants from like cultures such as ours here in the U.S., like, you know, Europe, Western Europe. We were bringing them in from Africa, from Asia, cultures that at that time could not even imagine a culture like ours. So what did they do? They came here. And they clustered together because that's how they were told, that's how they were moved, and they were moved to geographic locations and clustered together and they would continue to engage in their own culture again and enforce their culture. You know, part of that thing that where Cecil Rhodes had said that they had to deindustrialize the U.S., there was actually a document written in 1933 that talked about the destruction of the manufacturing base of the U.S. And they said it would probably, you know, they tried pushing it through a few different times, but it didn't really come about until 72, I believe it was, with the free trade agreement with Nixon. Now, by this point, Nixon had been impeached. You know, he was a man in disgrace, but obviously not, because he was given the most important job in the world at that time, deindustrialize the U.S. and send all of our manufacturing and production off. So what this free trade agreement did was it basically allowed us to export all of our dye and manufacturing technology, which at that time was treasonous to do it. You could be charged with treason for giving up dyeing technology and manufacturing technology to foreign countries. But the free trade agreement got rid of that. So, as we're bringing in these Chinese, we started off with China, because China was already, in 33, it said, China would become the new manufacturing base of the world because they've got a population of 1 billion people who have known nothing but tyranny for 3,000 years. They were slaves and they knew it, and it was all that they knew it throughout their entire history, and they would work, and they would do what they were told. What better workers do you want? So we started bringing in an influx. We started having this migration of Chinese students coming into the U.S., and we taught them all about production, management, so forth and so on, engineering, and then we sent them back to teach in these newly created Chinese colleges and universities to teach the new generation that would be up and coming how to be middle managers and upper managers. And then we taught them to work. And then we taught them how to run presses and all those other things. And now look where China is. They're the manufacturer of the world because it was mandated back in 1933.
Wow. So what you're literally saying on that one point was that China's rise to prominence as a manufacturing base was not due to their sole effort, but because there were other special interests making it happen, if I'm hearing you right.
Right, it was mandated back in 33. There was a document. It's open. I'm getting a blog up here, and I'm going to start actually talking about a lot of this stuff. You know, I talked about a lot of this stuff before, and I used to have all this stuff on hand with me on my computer back in Canada, where I could just easily dish it out. But I got a blog coming back up on this website. I'm going to start putting a lot of this stuff up there. Like I've always told people, don't believe me. Don't believe a damn thing I say. Treat me like a politician. You go out and you verify everything I say for yourselves. And you'll find that, unlike Alex Jones and a lot of other people here, everything I say is pretty much backed up by fact. Now, if I do say something wrong, people have called me on it, and I have openly on air said, I was wrong about this. This is what actually happened, and hey, it happens. I got 10,000 books rattling around in my head. I don't know everything, and sometimes I get things mixed up. But on these subjects right here, this is what happened. In 1933, there was a document that was written that talked about the need to destroy the manufacturing base of America, which would destroy our economic power in the world and bring us ripe for economic collapse and eventual submission to a global government.
Wow.
Now, the UN, if you read their own writings, the UN has openly stated, we are not going to be the global government. We are the stepping stone to the true New World Order. We are just the catalyst for this to come in. Now, all this is on their own website. All you got to do is go read the damn thing. They openly publish this, all of this stuff for you people. Why? Because they know we don't read. They publish this stuff for each other so they can read it, so everybody knows what the other one is doing, and they can see where the plan is at, and they know where everything's going, and they're like, okay, we're on our timeline, we're doing good. Everything that they said would happen for the last 150 years has happened. They're batting 1,000. They talked about bringing in the central banks into America to destroy, again, our economic freedom. When you break a people financially, those people become slaves. They talked about bringing in an income tax system into the U.S., even though it was unconstitutional and unlawful in our country. And what do you know? Even though Congress was told twice by the Supreme Court, they brought it in anyways, and then the Supreme Court started enforcing it. Even after they made Congress stop in the late 1800s, and again in the, 1917? 19, something like that, they made Congress stop. So what do? They got us into a war, so then they could tax us, and they said that this was only going to be temporary, to fund the war effort. But when the war ended, the taxation never did. Then they started taking our land, because if you have land, you become independent, because you can grow your own food. You can grow your own things to make clothes, things like that. So how do you get people off the land? Well, the first thing you do is tax the land so they no longer own it. They have the privilege of living there so long as they can pay. And even if there's no mortgage on that property, you never own it because you constantly have to pay on it for the rest of your life. You see what I'm saying? Now, after World War II, we really had to get people off the land. So then we created this little thing called HUD. And HUD started making all kinds of regulations on farmers, raw milk, things like that. And they had to engage in all these different practices instead of just being allowed to farm. And eventually their goal, what they said was to get rid of the small farmers and make it all corporate farmers. Well, what do you know? Here we are today. Through overregulation and overtaxation, you can't afford to be a farmer anymore. And those farmers that could not keep up, well, they lost their ability to farm, which means they couldn't generate revenue, which means they couldn't make any money, which means they couldn't pay for the taxes on the property. So then again, those properties came open for the government now to come in and take over. and then divvy out to, well, you know, whoever the next biggest buyer was or the next corporation. You know, that's how that went. I mean, they had a systematic plan for the destruction of our country. You know, when the UN first came out, they openly had a Department of Eugenics. Go back. Look. Do your history. But after Hitler, eugenics became a bad word, so we had to change. You know, I'm sorry, not after Hitler. Well, actually, after Hitler, it became a bad word. But people really weren't hype on it. You know, they really weren't hip on what that really meant. Then we actually started reading a few books and we understood what eugenics was, and then we started getting a whole backlash over that. They caught. So then they changed it to the Department of Population Control. Well, think about those three little words, or those two words, population control. You're controlling the population. How do you control a population? Well, it only leads you to a few inevitable conclusions. Restrict birth rates and get rid of the old.
Right, and, you know, once the bad guys start messing around with things like reproduction, I mean, that's definitely control freak behavior in a major way, obviously. Now, Randy, let's take the rest of this episode and let's focus more strongly on problem solving. And let's kind of also do a little bit of separating the wheat from the chaff, at least in one respect. Let's start with Ron Paul. Randy, do you think we can secure our liberties by simply voting Ron Paul into being the U.S. president?
Okay, let's take a look at that, okay? Ron Paul gets in as president. The first thing he wants to do is shut down the Fed, right? So he creates a bill to shut down the Fed or whatever it is. Congress puts it down. He vetoes them. They veto him. And in the end, it becomes one big veto and the president loses because you got 500 and what? 435 plus another 100. You got 435 people up in Congress who understand the agenda. And even if they don't understand the agenda, which most of them don't, most of them are just paid sycophants. They're getting paid money from individuals who do understand the agenda. So they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. So they're going to make sure he doesn't get that done. So he wants to bring us back on a gold standard. How's he going to do that? Do we have any gold? Well, we don't know. He can't even get the Fed audited. How is one man going to change 150 years worth of the destruction of our country that has been planned and implemented by tens of thousands of people?
Yeah, exactly. So
there is no knight in shining armor. I'm sorry, people. There is no knight in shining armor coming to save us.
Right, and I do think that one unfortunate thing is that
let's remember back to the Constitution. The president, for all intents and purposes, is nothing more than a glorified foreign ambassador and the commander-in-chief of the army. That's it. Who holds power in this country? Who holds all authority as far as the federal government goes?
Should be the Congress, if I remember correctly.
Bingo! So how is one man, the president, going to overturn Congress, which would be a violation of the bill of the Constitution? He doesn't have the power to. So how is one man as president, a glorified foreign ambassador, the commander-in-chief of our army, going to overturn all of Congress?
Yeah, that's not really going to happen for the most part. Then you have to consider all the administrative agencies, the bureaucratic agencies and that kind of thing. I mean, that's kind of its own animal of sorts. I mean, how is he going to rein in the alphabet soup boys? And despite the best of intentions. And so, and here's the other thing I think is even in some ways more important, especially not just the 2008 presidential campaign ads, but especially this election cycle. You know, he's the only one who can beat Obama. I remember that one. There was that one. So there's very much this propping up of him as a messianic figure, much like Charles Dyer, in case anyone wanted to connect those two little dots. It's almost as if the various dissidents who want to restore the republic, it's almost like they want to have a messianic figure. They want to have their proto-martyr, if you
will. We need to have our saviors, because we are not willing to step up to the plate and be our own saviors. We've gotten lazy.
Right,
exactly. The responsibility for your freedom was yours and yours alone. You stand up for it, you keep it, you take it, you hold on to it for everything that with your dear life, and you never let it go, and you never expect anybody else to ensure that you're free when you are not willing to do it yourself. That's how our country was founded.
Right, and so it's not that Ron Paul's bad. I mean, Ron Paul is very good at giving speeches and motivating people and that sort of thing. And also, to be perfectly frank, he is very good at making Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke look like a fool, and he's very good at it. Outside of that, though, and obviously, you know, his voting record is something that could be tackled another time. Outside of those two things, though, you know, this whole notion of getting him elected president, just as a method, again, guys, I'm just saying as a method, I would not place faith in that, much like Charles Dyer, you know, funding or something. It's like, let's focus on stuff that can really work.
Well, you know, hey, let's talk about that for 1 second, okay? And I just want to kind of bring up a point to show best of intentions out there. People want to free Charles Dyer, right? But let's go back. This goes back to how little we read and how little we understand that Constitution. Okay, so we got this federal government that everybody, that all these patriots say, not in my state, you don't have the right to come in my state and tell us what to do. Okay. They scream about the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment. Okay. But then what do they do with Dyer? They go into Oklahoma, a state that none of them are citizens in, or very few of them, I mean a very small amount are. They go into Oklahoma and they tell those courts what to do. And they think it's our right. What happened to the 10th? You see, we treat our Declaration of Independence and that Bill of Rights like a Chinese food buffet. We take what we like and we toss the rest aside if it does not fit our goals or our agenda. Now, when the federal case was going on, okay, I can see that being people's business. But honestly, that situation there, that's Oklahoma's business. It's up to the people of Oklahoma to say, our courts are corrupt, our police are corrupt, we need to go and fix this. That's an Oklahoma problem. Now, I can see people rallying behind him and things like that, but honestly, what makes any of us believe that we have the right to go into Oklahoma if we're not citizens of the state of Oklahoma and tell Oklahoma courts what to do? Doesn't that violate the 10th?
Wow, I never even thought about that before. That's an excellent point. So I think what you're kind of suggesting also in a larger sense is in a religious sense, there's always been the term about cafeteria Christianity. I think what you're kind of implying here is that there's also a sense of cafeteria constitutionality.
We treat it like a Chinese food buffet, man. We take what we like and we leave the rest when it doesn't fit our agenda.
And unfortunately, I think that that history and the evidence that supports it will prove the case one way or another. Let's take a look at also other things as far as problem solving goes. I think you mentioned much earlier for this episode about the COS-CLC. Randy, especially for those of, especially my listeners that kind of followed me off of Blog Talk Radio, what could you just give a brief overview of what exactly the Committee of Safety Common Law Court is?
Sure. Actually, that was created because of, Gary Hunt came up with this idea because of a conflict that was going on with me and another individual. And he decided to try and create something that would let people go and air their grievances and put it before a grand jury, provide evidence before a grand jury, you know, for your complaint against another individual. And if the grand jury decided there was enough evidence there to proceed to a trial, yes, you've substantiated your claims against this individual, it would then go to a petit jury and a judge. And the jury would sit there and look at all the evidence provided, look at the claims that you made or this individual made against you or you made it or you're making against this individual. And again, you know, the accused is always considered innocent in a court of law. It's up to the accuser to provide the proof. Well, you know, I presented my evidence against one Jim Stachowiak, a.k.a. Jim Stack, a.k.a. Lispy Jim, a.k.a. Freedom Fighter Jim, Freedom Fighter Radio, whatever it was. Because according to Jim, I was a CSIS, that's Canadian Secret Intelligence Services. I was a CSIS, FBI, COINTELPRO, which, by the way, COINTELPRO was FBI, so it shows how much he knew, and CIA. And I was infiltrating the Patriot community with my radio broadcast and wreaking havoc out there. And he called, said all kinds of stuff about me. I mean, it's all over the net. It's all, you know, well, it's actually not all over the net. It's all over his website, one website. And, you know, I got tired of it. So when Gary gave, you know, when Gary decided to try to make this thing happen, I was more than happy to jump on board with it. And I said, hey, you know what? Let's bring this to light. So I filed my charges against Jim for slander and defamation of character, inciting, you know, all kinds of charges. I mean, you've got the, you know, the verdict is there for everybody to see. It's at the Committee of Safety website. You go to comment. It's in the Liberty Tree forum. If there you go, somebody threw it up on there. It's at http://committee.org/court/index.htm. For those who are listening in on some other, on one of the other players and not in the chat room or on an archive, you can go in there and you can see, man. I presented 12 charges against him, 12 claims against him. The jury found him guilty of all, of 11 of them, and insufficient evidence on one of them. Now, I was away at the time. I was offline. I was up in West Virginia, and I didn't know that, you know, they were needing more, because I could have easily supplied more information about that other charge, but I didn't know. But that's okay. You know, I got 12. I got 11 out of 12. So now, Jim was given his chance to come in and prove his case against me. Well, you know, you need to be able to do something like provide income tax statements, W-2s, you know, pictures of me sitting in my office at the CSIS/FBI/COINTELPRO/CIA office. You know, paychecks perhaps. I wish I was getting one of those paychecks. Hell, man, I should be rich. I wouldn't have to be struggling to buy my pack and my gear and stuff like that. I'd be sitting pretty. I wouldn't have to be selling Joe Martino's book to try and make a couple bucks to keep this show up and running. I wouldn't have to take donations from people, but hey. So the court found Jim guilty of all charges, and now me, I can go out there and I can spread this to the world and let everybody know that these accusations that Jim has placed against me, these charges, these claims that he's made against me, a jury of my peers has found them to be false, and that my charges against him for defamation of character, slander, and all kinds of other stuff, he was found guilty of.
So, Randy, I think if we're hearing you correctly, the COS-CLC is basically an attempt to act as a third-party arbiter of sorts.
That's exactly it. You know, there is so much infighting in here, man. He said, she said, this and that. My God, man. It's
right,
like
right.
A playground
so,
out here.
Right.
But so, you know what? Let's act like adults and let's actually go out there and act. You know, you got a problem with somebody, take it to the court.
Right. So, in an attempt to solve internal balkanization, which is known in, vernacularly as infighting, the COS-CLC is a tool, a mechanism to really discover the truth and make it public, and then in the hope that by coming out with these verdicts, the public will, and especially political dissidents, will basically treat it seriously and not allow this kind of stuff to continue. And so, Randy, if you would be so inclined, I would like to read for everybody the entirety of that verdict.
Do you want to read it or do you want me to read it? You read it. I don't have it in front of me, but go ahead.
All right, everyone. The committee
here's an example of what happened, of what the findings were from the common law court. Now remember, these are the Pettit jury, the grand jurors, the judge. These were all people who volunteered for these positions. These are patriots who said this was a great idea. You know, this has got to stop. And if somebody's out there slandering somebody's good name or lying or provoking or inciting riot and rebellion or trying to overthrow our constitutional government and create a new government. By the way, everybody, newsflash, I'm actually going to be bringing a case up against somebody who's actually tried to abscond with our lawful government and change our republic and has elected himself president. You heard it first here. That's the next case coming up for me. But anyways, I'm actually got this one in the works now. I'm going after bigger dogs now. But these people are all volunteers. Guys like, just people like the listeners on this show, they're just volunteers. You know, and they sit there and they dig through this stuff and they listen to hours and hours and hours of proof and read through crap that I presented. And in the end, I was vindicated.
Right, exactly. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Committee of Safety Common Law Court verdict in the matter of Randy Mascarenhas versus James Stachowiak, docket number 110401. On April 14th, 2011, the accuser, Randy Mascarenhas, filed a complaint with this court. On May 1st, the complaint was sent to the grand jury. On August 1st, 2011, the grand jury issued with an 11-count indictment. On August 1st, 2011, the clerk of the court provided the accused, James Stachowiak, the indictment with an explanation that he could answer to the indictment or refuse to answer to the indictment. On August 8th, 2011, the accused agreed to answer to the indictment. On September 11th, 2011, instructions for trial were provided to both the accuser and the accused, and the courtroom was opened. Neither the accused or the accuser made opening statements nor any other comments during trial. On September 30th, 2011, the petite jury began deliberations on the 11 counts. On November 5th, 2011, the petite jury, based upon the evidence and testimony provided by both sides, came back with a verdict of guilty on 10 counts. And
was it 10? I lied then. See? Sorry, people, I lied to you. I thought it was 11.
With a verdict of guilty on 10 counts and not guilty on one count, to wit. Count one, guilty of slander. In the exhibit number 1-1, you put it in an unfavorable light and suggested illegal activity in your accusations of the accuser's morals and habits when you said, quote, Ranger Randy, Randy Mack, is in anal sex in Alberta, Canada, end quote. And, quote, that you came into this movement with deception and lies, end quote. Count two, not guilty of defamation.
I missed it on that one. I didn't submit enough evidence.
Count three, guilty of slander. In exhibit number 3-2, regarding the PayPal account that was set up for J4P, Charles Dyer, you claim that you will defend yourself and that Randy accused you of stealing money and having access to said PayPal account. Count four, guilty of incitement. In the exhibit number 3-2, you imply retribution to those who have made false accusations without proving any falsehood. Count five, guilty of defamation. In exhibit number 3-3, in that you have grouped Randy Mack and others with supporting one who you claim to be involved in illegal activities, including prostituting her children and an agent attempting to get others of participating in illegal activities. Count six, guilty of threat. In that exhibit number 3-3, in discussing Randy Mack, you have suggested the ease of using commonly available materials for targeting people. Count seven, guilty of incitement. In exhibit number 3-3, you stated that Randy Mack is in league with one who is trying to get militia members killed, thus inciting others to act against him. Count eight, guilty of defamation. In exhibit number 3-6, you state that Randy Mack, among others, is not accountable for his activities and support of others, and that he should be held to the same standard that we expect government to be held to. Count 9, guilty of defamation. In exhibit 3-12, you accuse Randy Mack of being a lapdog. Count 10, guilty of slander. In exhibit 4-1, you accuse Randy Mack of trying to destroy J4P Charles Dyer's donations. And count 11, guilty of defamation. in that in Exhibit 4-1 that you are attempting to defame and damage the reputation of Randy Mack with allegations that he sought to, quote, destroy J4P's donations, end quote. Every effort was made to provide for a fair trial. Each party, the accuser and the accused, were allowed to appoint one juror to the petite jury. The accused was provided the opportunity to counterfile against the accuser. No contesting of procedure was offered by either party. All evidence and testimony provided by either party was considered by the petite jury. Both parties were willing participants in this trial. The only consequences of this verdict, the only consequence of a verdict in this court will be public disclosure of the verdict and relevant evidence and testimony. The verdict of the petite jury is as unbiased as can be obtained by these means. It is void of extraneous and superfluous discussion, and each count was addressed individually and on its merit. The final decision, however, rests with those who read of this trial and understand the purpose of the trial and the complications of the verdict. And again, ladies and gentlemen, that was the Committee of Safety Common Law Court verdict in the matter of Randy Mascarenhas versus James Stachowiak, docket number 110401.
Woo! I won.
Yeah, I guess that's the really short version of putting it.
So, Jim, for you, buddy, you know what the bad thing is, man? Even if the jury all said that, Jim still keeps those lies up about me, and he still talks about them and spreads them. Ain't that a bitch?
But this.
So, you know, I'm just going to start posting this thing everywhere, man. You know, there's a lot of things I've been meaning to do. I've been meaning to promote the CLC a lot more. I've been meaning to market my broadcast a lot more and get back up to where my listener base used to be and then get 200,000 listeners over the next year. I've been meaning to do a lot of things, man. But, again, you know, I just haven't really been spending a ton of time online and, you know, it's hard to do it as a one man, as a one man show. I mean, you know, hell, if I had 100 other people, man, you know, that would be a hell of a lot easier. But, you know, so, you know, it's kind of up to everybody. You know, everybody has to take a responsibility in this, man. You know, if you like the ideas of the CLC, go there. Either promote it, suggest people go there to settle their disputes, file your own complaint against someone. Remember, though, it's voluntary on their end. But even if they don't show up, they're given an amount of time. If they don't show up, well, I guess maybe they'll, just be found, you know, the jury will find in favor of you, and then you can go post that everywhere. And let everybody know that this guy just lost in the Committee of Safety Common Law Court. You know, but these things are all up to you guys. You know, if you do not get involved with things, if you do not partake in things that actually work, that are trying to have some benefit to us, well, then nothing works. It all just goes away.
Right, exactly. Moving on, I did want to mention about the Under One banner petition. So, Randy, what is the You Have Tread on Me Under One banner petition?
That was the effort. That was that was the product of a 3-week debate with Gary Hunt. And let me tell you, that was a doozy of a debate. You know, I first met Gary over at RTR, Restore the Republic. What's his name? Franchise site. I met him and a couple of other people, and Gary and I were having a conversation, a debate, if you will, on have we done everything possible that we can to restore our constitutional and lawful government. And, you know, in the end, we ended up creating that You Have Tread on Me document, the You Have Tread on Me petition, hence the name of this broadcast and everything else that was going with it, as an olive branch, you know, as an olive branch petition to our federal government, just like our founding fathers put forth the olive branch petition to the king. It was meant to be something to get people off the fence and keep waiting, you know, and stop saying, well, we'll get them in the next 4 years. Well, we'll get them in the next 6 years, or we'll get them in the next 2 years. And stop protesting and stop doing all this other stuff and petitioning, you know, one petition, not this internet petition. Not one petition with 10,000 signatures behind it that's easy to throw away, but a petition delivered to your two senators and your congressmen, hard copy. And we envision millions of these going into all the congressmen and the senators. And they got to sign for them. And that took man hours to do. And then they're filling up in their office and coming over the fax lines. And people are just sending them in like crazy. But what it also does is it tells them that, you know, it fixes a lot of the problems that we have in this country, restores us back to a constitutional lawful government. It fills the holes and the cracks within the Constitution itself, because let's admit it, there's a lot of loopholes in that, man. And, you know, if you got a whole bunch of attorneys like Congress and all the lobbyists and all the special interest groups, you got a whole bunch of attorneys, man, you can engage in verbicide, destroy the meaning of words and twist the meaning of words. And then all of a sudden Congress has the power to do whatever the hell they want. So we made this document to be our last ditch effort as a peaceful resolution to our government. And the sole purpose was to restore constitutional lawful government as peacefully as they will allow us, which kind of throws the ball in their court. It puts it in their hands as to what they do. You know, but again, you know, if people don't get involved, they don't engage in it, it doesn't work. You know, now I see everybody else, you know, they're kind of trying to copy that. The great ones are always imitated but never duplicated. You know, other people are trying to copy that now and do their own little thing with it. And we got 10,000 people running off in 10,000 directions, and nobody, again, is focusing upon a common plan for a common goal. And like, you know, Gary had said before, you know, yeah, sure, why not? Let's have 10,000 different petitions. You know, let's have a whole bunch of 10,000 different petitions, and everybody's do their own thing. And so, you know, the feds can laugh at us even more and say, these SOBs can't even get their shit together. They can't even agree on anything. And everything will just become that much less effective. So, you know, if you look at that, the You Have Tread on Me petition, which you can find on two places. One is on my website, www.youhavetreadonme.com. There's a link there at the top. It says petition. This is not a petition like every other petition out there, though. This is a petition like what the Founding Fathers used to do. This is not like our petitions today. Just like everything else, man, we have pretty much destroyed the value of most everything that we do. But this is a petition upon which the Founding Fathers, I truly believe, would be proud. It was, like I said, it was fashioned after the Olive Branch petition. You can also find it at outpost-of-freedom.com, which is Gary Hunt's site. You just look at it there. There's a big link, bam, right on the front page there. You Have Tread on Me petition. You can download it. I even got a little audio up there saying, you know, talking about what it is and why you should participate in it and how it should be done. No emails, none of that. Hand-delivered, registered mail, fax it in, hard copy only. It's supposed to go to your two senators and your congressman. Me, I was feeling feisty that day. I sent it to my two senators, my congressman, my mayor, my governor, my city council. I let them all know. I'm tired. And I've had enough. And you will obey. Or we will dissolve the bonds that bind us, and we will enter into a state of nature. We will no longer observe your authority.
Right. And if you wouldn't mind, I would like to read the introductory paragraph to the petition to give the listeners an idea of just how, where this is coming from, because I think you mentioned about...
Gary wrote most of this up. Well, Gary wrote it all up. You know, I came in, you know, Gary wrote most of it, in fact. You know, it's all referenced on the bottom of it as well, with the, you know, in Constitution and things like, from the Constitution and so forth and so on, and the Bill of Rights, other things. You know, Gary did most of the work on this. I brought in, you know, some of the corporate aspects of it and some other things like that, but, you know, I got to hand it to Gary. He did most of the work on it, so...
Right, I think you mentioned that it's based on the Olive Branch petition, which, if my understanding is correct, the Olive Branch petition was kind of like the last ditch petition.
Yes, it was, to show people this government doesn't care. No matter how much you petition them, they're not going to listen. So then maybe they would realize and get off their asses and act.
Right, so... The document actually does take a while to read, so I'm not going to read the entire thing, but just the very first paragraph.
It's 2 pages. I could read it in 10 minutes.
Okay, I guess I could read the
beginning
whole
part. But read the beginning part. Give them a teaser of what it's like.
Okay, this is the "You Have Tread on Me" under one banner petition for redress of grievances. This petition is directed to those who allege to represent us in the halls of the Congress of the United States of America. You, who during your campaign for the votes of the people, made promises which you failed to keep. Those promises became the cause or reason for which the votes of the people were cast in your favor. It was the reliance on what you claim to be your course that was the bond of representation that was created when those votes were cast. It is your deviation from what you campaigned for that leads us to conclude that you no longer represent the will of the people who elected you to the office that you hold. On July 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was formally signed. This magnificent document provides an insight into the thinking of the Founding Fathers. For example, it provides their explanation of the purpose of government. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Those rights therein mentioned are enumerated as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Clearly, they have provided us an understanding that government was instituted to serve the interests of the people, not to serve the interests of the ruler or large commercial entities, which concept was so prevalent in Europe. They also provide us the reason they had taken on the formidable task of separating from England. Quote, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness, end quote. They also explain the difficulty in coming to the point of action with, quote, prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed, end quote. Next, they explain the obligation that they impose upon the future, should events demonstrate that the government has deviated from its proper purpose, quote, but when long trains of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide for new guards for their future security, end quote. 12 years later, June 21st, 1788, the states ratified a constitution which was the document that authorized and created a government under the authority of the people. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The government of the United States of America is a creation of the people of the United States of America. It is not a power unto itself. Rather, it is a governing body, not a ruling body, which was created to manage the affairs of the government, not the affairs of the people. As a condition of ratification, the people made a call for a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, when ratified on December 15, 1791, was, as the Constitution, preceded by a preamble setting forth its purpose. The preamble anticipated that some of the people's concerns not addressed in the Constitution should be addressed to assure that the proper role of government be observed. It read, the conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution, expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. The Bill of Rights contained two articles that are significant in light of our concerns. Article 9 says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Article 10 says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. understanding that we are the posterity identified in the preamble to the Constitution, we come forward today to present to you the Congress of the United States of America, the creation of we the people, with demands that must be resolved by you who serve us in Washington, D.C. These demands are consistent with the Constitution and the rights retained by the states and the people. They are demands that must be met for the people to continue to allow the existence of that government created by them. Should these demands not be met by the sitting Congress, the people will conclude that this Congress no longer serves the people, and that you have, by that absence of respect for the people and their will, dissolved any obligation of respect once due you by the people. You, by your refusal to act in accordance with the Constitution, will become rebels to that Constitution and to the people. These demands are presented to you, the members of the Congress, as our plea that you right yourselves by acting on our behalf. If you fail to act, you have, by that omission, dissolved the bonds that have, so long, bound us together. And then the petition continues with the specific demands if you really want to get into it. But that is pretty much the opening to the Under One Banner petition.
Hoorah.
So as you can see, ladies and gentlemen, this is not – the Under One Banner petition is not just simply a – we're just kind of upset about this, like, one, tiny aspect thing with, Big Brother, with RFID chips, or with some other tiny little thing. No, this is kind of going for the big kahuna. It's designed, as we mentioned, to go for, in its spirit of the olive branch petition, really. This is the last time, basically. And you can see it just in the introductory portion of it, even before we get into the demands with stuff with the military and banking and legislation and all sorts of other areas. That's just the opening. That's how it starts.
It's really short. It's only 2 pages. You can get a 2-page version. It's a quick 10-minute read, if that. Check it out.
Right, and I think the last thing I did want to tackle with you tonight, if you'd be so kind as to engage me, would be a brief look at what committees of safety are. So, Randy, what are committees of safety? Why should we care about them?
Now, the committees of safety were formed by our founding fathers to basically cover the areas in which the government wasn't capable of handling at the time or wasn't engaging upon. It later became our actual governments within the areas. There's a story of Governor Andros. I forgot the exact year. I'm sure Gary will pop it up here for me in the chat room real quick. But Governor Andros was, he was just violating the rights of those Englishmen. He was violating Magna Carta. He was violating everything else about them. And the militia at the time, remember, militia all must be subordinate to a civil authority. The militia was subordinate to Governor Andros. They revoked that subordination, turned to the people, and asked them to form the committees of safety, because these committees of safety were very old. I mean, we've got records of them being formed in the 1500s, in the 1600s. Cromwell used the committees of safety to shut down Parliament when Parliament was going rampant. So they turned to the people. They asked the people to create this civil body. The people formed a committee of safety. The militia in Massachusetts there, I don't know exactly which one or which town it was in. It doesn't really state, but they then turned to that committee of safety, subordinated to them. The committee of safety told them to go and arrest Governor Andros. Governor Andros was then arrested, shackled, put into jail. A letter was sent to the king saying, come get your man. The king sent for Governor Andros. Andros went home, and never, ever once did Andros or the king ever speak out against the actions of those colonists, because they acted within the realm of their rights.
Wow. So, okay, well, Randy, now, I think we've all heard, you know, in the public fool system, as well as from other sources, about, you know, the committees of correspondence, how important it was to have, I mean, I guess to kind of bring it full circle, I think it might be accurate to say that committees of correspondence were essentially the colonial, or their version of the alternative media. Assuming that's true, then, you know, we can go off of that. But the point is that, you know, we've heard about committees of correspondence, you know, ad nauseum, but, well, why haven't we heard about committees of safety? I mean, what's going on there? Could you take a little bit and kind of describe why all that focus on committees of correspondence, but we've never heard about committees of safety? I mean, why is that the case?
Well, you know, that was interesting. You know, the Founding Fathers used two infrastructures to create a free nation for men. They used the committees of safety, which were based upon local government. Those local townships would have their committee of safety. They would elect delegates to go to a county committee of safety. That county committee of safety was subordinate to those local towns. The counties would gather their delegates who were elected from the town delegates. They would elect them to represent, to go up to the state level for state committee meetings. Those states would elect those delegates at the state level to represent them in the national level, which everybody out there was familiar with, the Continental Congress. That was the Committee of Safety. That Continental Congress became our government, became our national government. The Committees of Safety became our government during the interim before the Articles of Confederation were in. And, you know, they did what needed to be done. They forged a nation, they freed a people, and they made history, something that had never been done in the history of the world. So much of our power of we the people comes from those areas. I mean, you know, the committees didn't just last then. You know, as we made our westward expansion, you'll find that the committees of safety were everywhere. There's committees of safety in Washington State. You know, they would muster the militia for Indian attacks. They would handle whatever needed to be done before there was government there. These were territories. No government, really. So the committees of safety took care of whatever deficiencies were that the government was not able to take care of. And that's what they did. I mean, you'll find records of the committees of safety, appointing the officers for the militia. Because no appointment for officer level, you know, for captains and above is ever made without without appointment. Even today, you know, those ranks, those appointments come from Congress. For our Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, they all come from Congress. We still uphold these traditions today. They were vital. And, you know, a lot of our power of we the people comes from these committees of safety, but if nobody knows about them, well, then what does that do for we the people? It leaves us kind of powerless. It leaves us, you know, with petitions and protests and no viable alternative in which to maintain and hold our freedom. You know, and also, if the government becomes inimical to our freedom, who do those militias subordinate to then? You know, the English understood this when they got Magna Carta, because at that point the militia was put in the hands of the people. It was the people's army, if you will, and it had to be subordinate to a civil authority. We maintain that to this very day. These things were important. So when the government became inimical to one's freedom or in something, who would those militias subordinate to? If they didn't subordinate to any civil authority, they would become warlords. The threat was always there that he with the most swords or the biggest guns would become warlords. Look at Castro. Look at Pol Pot, Pinochet. Look at all these people. They subordinated to nobody except themselves, and they had the guns to back it up.
Right. So what exactly would be the relationship between, like, a committee of safety and a militia unit?
Your militias would subordinate to the committee of safety. They would, you know, ensure, you know, the committees used to pay when militia were active in active duty, they would get paid. There's records showing that the committees of state were paying them. You know, there's an excellent book out there written by Gavin. It's called The First Fight. The Minutemen, The First Fight. It gives an excellent accounting of the militia, the creation of our militia in America, because even though we had militia under the king, we got rid of a lot of the people that were in that militia because they were loyalists, and we formed our own militia again. But with them, we created the committees of safety as well. We reinstituted the committees of safety, I should say. We didn't create them, we reinstituted them. That gives an excellent accounting of the committees of safety. And also, for anybody that's interested, Gary and I have done several episodes about the committees of safety. Each one's about 2 hours long. You can find them real easily. You can find them at www.outpost-of-freedom.com. You go to the radio page there, and you'll just scroll down until you see Committees of Safety Part 1, Part 2. And you can also go to the www.committee.org website. Get a whole ton of information there. I even created a zip download file there that has all kinds of information in it. The audio files, documents, paperwork, things like that. Even oaths of office if you're looking at creating your own. Secrecy oaths, things like that. So, you know, again, though, you got to learn. You got to read. You have to understand in order to enact. If you are uneducated, how are you going to act in an educated manner to free yourself from tyranny? If you do not know your history, you fail to repeat the same mistakes constantly. You know, the one thing man has learned from history is that man does not learn from history. So, why don't we pick up a history book? And if you're going to pick one up, pick up that book. The Minutemen, The First Fight by Gavin. Exceptional read.
Now, I think throughout this particular episode, I think you've been mentioning a particular individual several times. I believe that was Gary Hunt, yes?
Yeah, Gary Hunt.
Right. I actually interviewed him on a previous episode. And for the listeners, if you go to my blog, it was episode 44, Outpost of Freedom, and just follow the links to an archive copy, or backup archive copy, actually. But yes. That was a wonderful, wonderful interview, and I'm hearing a lot of the kind of same, not only the same content, but also the same energy that I get from you as I get from him. It's very positive and uplifting, which is something that I kind of have a tough time finding in the alternative media. I will say that much. Now, Randy, as we begin to close out. Obviously, in the show description, it says that you are a militia member. I believe that was the Ohio Minutemen, correct? OHMM?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Ohio Minutemen Militia.
Okay. And how has there been any moves forward towards getting a committee of safety established in terms of and all that good stuff, getting all those things going?
Well, I'm working on getting committees of safety formed up here in Ottawa County and in Fremont County. I'm in Ottawa County. There's a town 10 miles to me called Port Clinton. It's a bigger town. It's got Walmarts and all that other good stuff there. I'm in a village. And there's another town 10 miles the opposite direction of me, or due south of me, that is in Sandusky County. But they're both really close, so I'm going to those two population centers trying to get people together and form a committee of safety here. I've also got Lieutenant Josh Miller. Good man, great man. Energy. Lots of energy, man. He's a doer. He gets out there, man. He uses the internet like a tool, and then he gets out there on the streets, and he talks to people face-to-face. He talks to groups of people. He's actually meeting with a ton of people. Him and Lieutenant Marshall are wanting to foreign committees of safety up there as well. I'm talking to other people throughout the state as well. So hopefully, you know, and I would love to see a committee of safety in every county here in the state of Ohio within the next year. Charlie Mike One is in Ohio. He's talking about committees of safety as well. So, you know, maybe we can get these things going. But again, you know, it takes people's involvement. It takes people's involvement in order to make anything happen. If you don't get involved, nothing happens. If you don't try to make that change, nothing will ever change.
Right, of course, and whether it's with one of the like the COSCLC type thing, or whether it's with more brick and mortar committees of safety, or any of the other things we've mentioned tonight, yeah, you need good quality personnel, which part of that means you need people who are willing to work, who are smart and willing to work hard, and that kind of thing. It's really just kind of incumbent to have really the good guys doing good work and not, you know, spinning around with distractions or other methods that do not yield the benefits that they claim to. So, Randy, as we start
Hang on, real quick. One thing else I want to mention about that. You know, there's been committees of safety that have been forming, and so far I've got mixed feelings about them. You know, it is what it is. But I've learned from all of their mistakes, or I've seen the problems that can arise within them. So what I'm going to be doing now is I've learned from them. I'm going to be doing things a little bit differently than how they were formed. You know, one tried to form on a state level and then form the local county levels. I'm going to work on the county levels first. I'm also going to be doing, though, I mentioned my blog a couple times. I'm going to have a blog on there called The Birth of a Committee of Safety. And I'm going to go through a week by week or every 2 week account of what has gone on with the birth and the formation and the workings of that committee of safety as much as I can. And hopefully it will be a template for other people who understand what the committees are for, see the need for them, but really don't know how to go about getting one. So I'm going to lay out a blow by blow account of the creation of the committees of safety here in Ottawa County and in Sandusky. It'll be full of our accomplishments, our failures, if they will, the problems that arise and how we've dealt with them. So this might help other people who might encounter these same problems say, look, this is what the problem they had there, very similar to our problem. Here's how they resolved it. Let's try and do the same thing here. You know, so people can actually go out there and actually see how something's being formed and created and how it's working.
Wow, that does sound quite terrific. I think a lot of folks, good folks, would be very interested in looking forward to that. As we start to close out for tonight, what would you suggest that the new guys, just the brand new guys who are hearing this both now and in the future, what is the first thing that you would suggest that the brand new guys start doing, like from rock bottom?
Stay off the internet as much as you can. Actually get out in the street. Use it as a tool. Learn. You know, get online. Do research. Learn, man. I cannot disparage, researching on the internet. But, man, don't get involved in the politics and the BS. Find a couple decent websites you can go to where you can get information. You know, where there's a group of people there. No infighting. No garbage. None of that. Just people who actually care about this country and trying to solve problems. Again, always, man, get out on the streets and work locally. Forget about the federal government, okay? It's lost to you. The only place you're really going to make any effect, or you're going to affect any changes on your county, is on your local level. Your town and your county. We'll start there, work there, focus there. Start building these infrastructures that our founding fathers did. And it's not just for resistance to the government or anything like that. We prepare, in OHMM, we prepare for all kinds of disasters, both natural and man-made. You know, I don't want to go up against the federal government. I don't want to go up against the state government. My militia exists for the security of a free state and the security of our free communities. That's what we exist for. Learn as much as you can. Don't read the online garbage, and don't get caught up on the online crap. Grab some books. If you need a list of books, I tell you what, I got the Randy Mac Top 10 list of books to read. These are books that I've picked out of at least probably 10,000 books that I've read. This is the top 10 list. If you'd like a copy of that list, let me know. Email me at randymac@youhavetreadonme.com. These are the books that help me understand exactly what's going on and what needs to be done. One of the books is listed right there on my website, Resistance to Tyranny. That book right there is an essential handbook for all militia and committees of safety. Every committee of safety should have several copies. Every militia member should have one. Hell, I believe that every American should be mandated to read this damn book. That's the only mandate I would ever make upon any American, except for the fact that you do your duty to your county and to your town, your county, your state. You keep your freedom. That's your duty. Other than that, read that book. If you really want to know what to read that book. Gavin's book, you know, John Gavin, The Minutemen, The First Fight, a must read. So you can understand what our founding fathers were going through and why they did what they did and how they did it. So don't get caught up in the games, though. I mean, there's a lot of games out there. Just don't do it. Stay away from it. Avoid them, man. Choose your friends wisely. You know, the internet is a tool. It's not a lifestyle. Those people that are living in a state clear across on the other side of the country from you, if they have something to offer you, great. If they can help and educate you, great. But in the end, when it comes down to it, they're not your neighbors. You need to be talking to your neighbors. You need to be engaging in your local community. That's where you need to spend the majority of your time at.
Very good and sound advice. And even for those of us who have been
listen to this broadcast. I would always recommend that.
Of course, easily. Well, and that's very good and sound advice to give. And also for those of us who have been doing this for quite a while, I mean, same thing for us, you know, I mean, considering how much stuff we've done that's, you know, strictly online and see how far it's gotten us, you know, versus doing stuff offline locally.
You know, not just that, you know, it's something else I would recommend. One more thing. You know, we talk about we do this for our families and we do this for our freedom and we do this for our lives and things like that. Don't forget about those things. You know, I myself have often gotten wrapped up in all of this, and I forget about what's important to me. I forget about those around me. I forget about my family, my friends sometimes. You know, when all we do is worry about this and focus on this, we stop engaging in our freedoms, and we have given them up at that point. Your life was meant to be lived and enjoyed, to be engaged upon. Go out and engage upon your freedoms. You say you fight, you're doing this for your family, spend time with your family. Get your family strong. Get your family cohesive again. Make them a strong unit, a strong family unit again. Engage with them. Get to know them again. If you don't know them, you better get to know them. Or you'll become a statistic. 52% of all marriages end in divorce. Don't become a statistic. Live your freedom. If this is what you're fighting for, then start engaging in it as well. Go and enjoy your life.
Exactly. Additionally, good sound advice that we all should heed. And, you know, in closing, I just want to emphasize and reiterate to some degree that, again, it's a tool. And, you know, I've never said this publicly before, but I will say it now that, well, it's fine. But, you know, the intention behind my podcast is that it's not just for the people now. It's also for the people, I would say, the next two or three generations specifically. So after I'm dead, you can still figure out about stuff that we were doing now and trying to do kind of like a think tank thing now, so that if things go down really badly and we fail, at least you guys in the future, some of you who don't even exist yet, can probably kind of pick up where we left off.
Are you trying to be famous in the future, Sleepy?
I'm quite with something that can be got into in a later broadcast. Some of my concerns revolving just how the availability of good quality personnel. But suffice
leave
it to say,
for the future, leave something for posterity. You know, they didn't leave. Right. You know, they really the founding fathers didn't really leave us a blueprint, a handbook. You know, we actually had to study to understand what they did. You know, but this broadcast, I mean, if you listen to this broadcast from its very inception 3 or 4 years ago to now, then we give you that blueprint. We spell it out for you. It's real handy and real easy. So for you future people who aren't even, you know, who aren't even thoughts in your parents' loins yet, this is for you, just in case.
Right, and it's a good, it's definitely a good backup plan. And same goes with my my blog post writings and some of my videos that I made way back when, which of course now are, you know, mirrored on other stuff since I closed down my YouTube channel. But yeah, exactly. It's just, it's not just for the people now. It's also, for the future, just in case the worst happens and, you know, we suck, then at least there's a chance, a possible chance later for other people to take up the mantle, if you will, and carry on the good fight, so to speak. So at least our pain and suffering wasn't totally in vain. At least something good can be gleaned from it. Granted, not in our own lifetimes, but again, this is a backup I'm talking about here. Then maybe something good can happen later. And that's pretty much – and also this is the other thing too. You know, what if the internet gets shut down tomorrow? So
neighbors, I'm not worried about it.
Right, but
I still have people I can talk to.
Right,
all my friends aren't online.
Right, but let's assume it stops, or they the establishment implements Internet 2, whatever the equivalent is. You know, we need to have stuff that's off internet that's archived, and there's various ways and means of doing that. And heck, that could be a broadcast topic in and of itself. The point though is that, you know, I've been telling my readers and listeners, you know, as soon as I post, you know, put up a blog post or I, you know, or, you know, when a podcast is available or whatever, or sometimes I just, you know, hand it to people privately, you know, get this archived on your machine, get it archived onto like a CDR, get it archived onto like a spare memory stick, just do it. And then, you know, again, it's also known as this was something I talked about way back when in a blog post of mine, but it's something I like to call the time capsule strategy. So just in case our current efforts go down badly, there's always a chance for other people to come later and pick up the torch and carry it. And now, granted, now that's not an excuse to not do anything now. We need to push as hard as we possibly can because it's our lifetime. This is happening in our lifetime. This is one chance we get for ourselves personally. But if we personally fail, then at least other people have a chance to at least, you know, benefit from our, you know, pain and suffering. So in that way, something good can be brought out of what is otherwise an extremely shitty situation.
Me? I want to go for the time machine theory, for the time machine strategy, man. I want to take news clips, newspaper clippings, this broadcast, take them back in time and show them, hey, this is what happens in the future if you don't do something now.
Right, but also notice this too, guys. but also notice the establishment.
Going H.G. Wells on you.
Right. Well, but also, guys, notice, too, that the establishment has backup plans. Well, not only do they have, like, a plan and alternate plans and side plans, but they have backup plans, too. I'm just saying, let's just have one backup plan for right now. And, yes, there is, as mentioned in the chat room, the plan for the restoration of constitutional government, which, of course, I mentioned on episode 44, the interview I did with Gary Hunt, which was Outpost of Freedom. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is something that needs to be done now. I'm just saying that kind of playing it safe in one sense, let's also have some backups. But again, this doesn't mean that you should be lazy about doing stuff you need to be doing, like trying to get set up a committee of safety, like doing your PT and practicing closer to drill and your marksmanship and the rest of it. It's just that, hey, look, I mean, there's this game that we are stuck with playing with the establishment is just that, but unfortunately, very real things are happening because of it, and because we are forced to play this game, it would kind of behoove us to figure out how it works and how to get around it, and ultimately to win this freaking thing, so we can secure our liberties and be done with it, that we can actually get on with our lives and spend time with our families and go on and do other things. That's kind of the whole point. That's what secure your liberties means. But
well, why don't you start by securing your liberties, man, by just engaging in your liberties now?
Exactly. Yeah.
No, when you don't exercise your freedom, it atrophies. And you don't lose your freedom. You give it up willingly. Nobody takes your freedom away. You choose not to engage upon it. You know, they can write all the laws they want saying you can't do this and you can't do that. But I remember reading Jefferson's writings, and it says, there is no victim, there is no crime. Now, don't mess with your neighbors. Don't victimize them. Don't create victims and live your life. And if you choose to engage in your freedoms vehemently, then you have not given them up. If you exercise them daily, you have not given them up. That's the reality of the situation, people. You know, it's just a piece of paper that says you can't do this. You're a living, breathing person. That little piece of paper was written by other people who really have no more authority than you. Because remember, we created government. Government answers to us. We don't answer to them. They exist for us, not us for them. Engage in your freedoms daily.
Well, absolutely. I mean, your liberties atrophy if it's not exercised like a muscle. Oh, absolutely. And again, even with the next generation, you've got to teach them the same thing. And absolutely. No doubt about it. So anywho, I would like to thank you, Randy, very much for coming on tonight. I greatly appreciate it. And I also want to thank you for giving the Last Best Deal podcast a new home.
You're welcome, man. It's no problem. You know, I was more than happy to have you come on board. Like I said, you know, I really am going to work this year to get our listener base back up and then have it exceeded by 10 times. I want to get it to 100,000 listeners per broadcast. In order to do that, you know, hey, I'm not for everybody. Not everybody wants to listen to Randy Mack. Other people want to listen to other things. You know, and I cover what I do well. I want other people to come on board and cover what they do well. So, you know, hey, but before we go there, on that kind of subject, next week, we are going to be broadcasting off of Truth Finders Network. TruthFindersNetwork.com, and they're going to have a whole host of other hosts there and everything, but me and all my hosts here are going to be going over there as well, and we'll be broadcasting, well, as always, here at UofTreadMe.com. We'll find us over there at TruthFindersNetwork.com. Great bunch of people over there, so, you know, no games, no BS, and, you know, so that's what we'll be teaming up and joining efforts over there. So I just want to let everybody know about that. If you have any questions, as always, you know, feel free to email me, randymack@uofTreadMe.com. Slave, you want to toss your email out there for anybody?
What I will say is that my email address is available on my blog. Just go to the quizzes tab. And I kind of also, as kind of a vetting mechanism, I'm kind of curious if people would actually take like a political quiz and then send me their results, and then I will return mine. But my email is located on that page. So, Randy, I would like to thank you very much for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Not a problem. And also, you know, one more thing. You know, our founding fathers, you know, Kelly's the GM over at TFN. She made a comment, if we can't all come together as one force, no plan will work. And we are beyond writing and signing as time to act. Well, you know, our founding fathers, they gave one last chance, the olive branch petition. They gave that government one last chance to concede to their wishes, to respect their rights as free men. You know, we're offering one more chance for them, and that's it. You know, I sent mine in. They never responded back. I got a thank you letter, and I got a thank you letter from one of my congressmen, though. And he encouraged me to donate and support him, even though he's a big anti-gun activist. So this was in New Mexico. He didn't even read it. So at that point, I engaged myself in a state of nature now. I recognize the Declaration of Independence. I recognize the Bill of Rights. That's what I recognize. I live in a state of nature now. How about you?
Absolutely food for thought, no doubt about it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, for next week's episode on Saturday, April 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 Central, we will examine a particular monetary reform proposal. I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody. Be safe. Be free.